bigger. Take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn.
Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
This week in Radical History for the week starting February 23rd.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in Radical History, on February 23rd in 1971, Lieutenant William Calley confesses he directed the mass execution of South Vietnamese civilians at My Lai and implicates his commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, who he says issued the orders to murder. Both are dandies of the right-wingers who support their illegal activities. By the way, the initial investigating officer of the My Lai massacre who started the cover-up was then First Lieutenant Colin Powell of the Bush administration fame. Also more news on February 23rd for 1981. The White Papers on El Salvador issued by the State Department defending U.S. intervention and secret intervention and support of right-wing militia takeover of the government. One of the many atrocities the U.S. supported was death squads. The most infamous of them was the assassination of Catholic Bishop Oscar Romero, who was shot during a mass, a month after publicly asking U.S. government to stop military aid to El Salvadorian government. Also at his funeral, the government military bombers and snipers massacred 42 mourners.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so.
More illegal American interest in 1989. Lieutenant Colonel Ollie North is on trial for illegally selling weapons to Iran so that unlimited funds would still be available for the CIA's illegal and undeclared war against Nicaragua. Today, federal prosecutor Walsh agrees to drop the conspiracy charges against North. Though eventually found guilty of the cover-up, President Bush Sr. would give Ollie a Christmas pardon. Merry Christmas, Ollie North. Thanks for violating the Constitution for us.
We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
This week in Radical History for February 24th, 1899, more of the same in Nicaragua. U.S. Marines begin fighting in the Blue Fields and mine its harbor, all to protect American interests. Also on February 24th, 1912, labor activist Elizabeth Flynn heads the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike of 20,000 women. Later today, police would attack 150 children and their parents at the town railroad station to suppress the strike. Also on February 24th, 1968, Pete Seeger, blacklisted for years on network television, is finally allowed to sing his previously censored Waist Deep in the Big Muddy on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. The Smothers Brothers show itself would eventually get axed, despite its high ratings, as corporate sponsors threaten to cancel network contracts because of the controversial acts the Smothers Brothers allow on their show.
Well, I'm not going to play it anymore. I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This week in Radical History for February 25th, 1860, about 100 Wyatt Indian men, women, and children were massacred during the World Renewal Ceremony. The massacre was carried out by white immigrants who had just settled in the area since 1850 as part of the California Gold Rush. The massacre was particularly grisly because the men who paddled to the island used hatchets, axes, and clubs to murder the victims. They purposefully avoided using their guns so that local residents in nearby town would not hear the slaughter. A little bit of Wisconsin news on February 25, 1902. The mill manager of Whiting Paper Company in Plover, Wisconsin, discharges a shipping clerk who is trying to organize workers in the plant. His outraged co-workers held a protest rally and demanded the company to reinstate the clerk. When nothing happened, 25 union men shut down the plant and walked out, followed by about 20 women employed in the finishing room. By April, strikes disrupted plants up and down the Wisconsin River Valley. The American Federation of Labor and the Wisconsin State Federation of Labor sent support, but companies stood firm and by the end of April defeated the strikers. Well, lately the Washington Post has been in the news, and also in 1908 on this date, the Washington Post proposes that all anarchists be put to death, whether culpable or not, of any crime or offense. Also on February 25, 1913, the Patterson Silk Strike begins, involving over 20,000 workers. It would last for 6 months. Also on February 25, 1918, newspaper report that government charged Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman for working as German spies in foreign countries. Those charges, of course, would be later dismissed. 1 year later, Go Ahead, a circular attributed to American anarchists, appears throughout New England. In it, American anarchists threaten to dynamite officials in retaliation for the ongoing deportation and repression of anarchists are enduring. When pushed, often people push back. In related news on this date in 1920, anarchists Roberto Alia and Andrea Salzdito are taken into custody by the Department of Justice without warrant or being arrested. They're held and beaten for 8 weeks and not allowed to contact family, friends, or lawyers in an effort to get them informed on fellow anarchists. Attorney General Palmer's raid of terror was going full stream against immigrant radicals. To Palmer and his zealous band of immigrant pursuers, they were on a mission to rid the country of Red Satans, or anarchists who seemed bent on dismantling America's free enterprise system. A couple more items for February 25, 1964. 172,000 students boycott Chicago schools to protest segregation. Also on that date in 1970, Vista Vista, California, Bank of America burns, and riots break out to protest the Chicago 7 guilty verdicts, which ends with a lot of Bank of America buildings in flames. Part of a nationwide upheaval against the verdicts came down on the 19th, with 500,000 people in the streets, and explosions in 3 office buildings in New York, as well as more attacks in California, Washington, Maryland, and Michigan. Also on that date in 1993 in India, 60,000 preemptively arrested to prevent a demonstration against the ruling government. Last on this date in 1994, Israel, Jewish settler opens fire, kills 29 Palestinians praying in the mosque in Hebron. Oddly, Israeli government does not rush in and declare martial law on bulldoze Jewish homes in response. Barak Goldman, an American Orthodox Israel doctor who murdered 29 Arabs with automatic weapons, was proclaimed by some Jews to be a Kadash, meaning holy. This week in radical history for February 26, 1932, the man in black, Johnny Cash, is born. Jamie Lee Jackson on this date, February 26, 1965, was a young, unarmed civil rights protester who was shot by an Alabama state trooper. Jackson's death was among the many abuses of African Americans had to endure, and the Selma and Montgomery marches would spring up around them as important events in the American civil rights movement. Also on this date in 1974, Henry Ford, an anti-Semite, Nazi sympathizer, was revealed in a Senate report that Ford made tons of money on both sides of Axis and Allies of the war. It's the American way, after all, free market economics, etc. His profits from the Nazis still circulate in U.S. government politics to this day. Yeah, let's bail them all out. Have you driven your Ford lately?
This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 26, 1976, the dead body of Anna Mae Pitzel Aquash was found. Anna Mae was a prominent member of the American Indian Movement. It is generally believed that she was executed by other AIM members who were convinced that she was an informant for the FBI. One thing is certain, the murder of Anna Mae Aquash was a direct result of the tactics used by the FBI's counterintelligence program, which regularly used disinformation and lies to plant suspicions and divide the American Indian Movement. Using these tactics, the FBI wiped out many amazing revolutionaries through murder and imprisonment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. On this day, February 27th in 1880, writer and poet Angelina Weld Grimke was born to a white mother and a black father. Due to racial tensions, Grimpy's mother left the family, and from the time that Angelina was 7 years old, she was raised by her father and his family in Boston. Throughout her life, Angelina Grimke published many literary pieces, from poetry to short stories. A lot of Grimke's work was based on her experience as a biracial woman in America, and also on the isolation she felt as a lesbian woman in the late 1800s. On this day, February 28th in 1525, the last Aztec emperor, Cuauhtémoc, was assassinated. When Cuauhtémoc came to power 5 years earlier, the Spanish had already begun their conquest of the Americas. The Aztec Empire fought the Spanish off for as long as they could, but in 1521, Emperor Cuauhtémoc was forced to surrender to Hernán Cortés. 4 years later, Cortés took Cuauhtémoc to Honduras, where he ordered him to be hung. Spanish colonization of the Americas continued, and the indigenous people, once conquered, were often exploited and murdered. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on February 28, 1861, six of 44 chiefs in the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho sign a treaty with Fort Wise, agreeing to cede their lands and live on a small reservation in southwest Colorado. The U.S. Commissioner of Indian Affairs issues medals, blankets, sugars, and tobacco. Ah, six of the 44 chiefs, good enough. Also on this date in 1977, more Native American news as the American government seized the Black Hills from the Lakota Sioux in violation of a treaty they signed years earlier. Now, what a surprise.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
A couple more items. 1933 in Germany. Following yesterday's burning of the Berlin Reichstag, torched by the Nazis, the propaganda arm blames the anarchists and unionists to rally their people. You say Reichstag, I say Pearl Harbor, I say WMD, you say 9/11, I say JFK, you say... Lastly, in this date in 1986, though the comments were on tape, acting President Reagan denies he called the reporter sons of a bitches. The presidential mouthpiece, Larry Speaks, claimed Reagan said, "It's sunny, and you're rich." This week in Radical History for March 1st, the last one for this week, 1790, the first census count that includes slaves and free blacks. Native Americans? Don't include them. Also March 1st, 1875, Congress gives African Americans the right to serve on juries in the wake of the Civil War. Black men were briefly able to vote and hold elected offices until Jim Crow laws came into play about a year later. Also on March 1st, 1906, Emma Goldman publishes the first anarchist paper called Mother Earth. Also on this date in 1921 in Russia, 15,000 mutiny at Kronstadt against Marxist tyranny. From March 1st to March 17th, the old Bolshevik stronghold of Kronstadt rises, demanding free elections to adopt a 15-point program of political and economic demands, a program in open defiance of Bolshevik party control of the Soviet state. Almost immediately, the Bolsheviks denounced the uprising as a White Guard plot of counter-revolutionary conspirators. Less than 3 weeks later, on March 17, Kronstadt was subdued by a bloody assault by the select Red Army units. The Kronstadt Uprising, to all appearances, had little more to do with passing an episode of bitter history of civil war. We can now say, however, that the Kronstadt Uprising marked the end of the Russian Revolution itself. Lastly, on this date in 1971, the Weatherman Underground bombs U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. in retaliation for the decision for America to invade Laos. Here's part of the Weatherman Underground Communique No. 5.
We did not choose to live in a time of war. We chose only to become guerrillas and to urge our people to prepare for war rather than become accomplices in the genocide of our sisters and brothers. We learned from American history about policies of extermination of an entire people and their magnificent cultures, the Indians, the blacks, the Vietnamese. We are making plans to resist with all of our creativity. Students and hippies who now hear peace talk from the white man must remember how talk of peace was used against the Indians and preached to the blacks. Today, many student leaders have cut their hair and called for peace. They say young people shouldn't provoke the government, and they receive in return promises of peaceful change. Promises of peace from a government that bombs Cambodia while talking about an end to war, that killed students at Jackson and Kent while calling for responsibility on campus, that murdered Fred Hampton and hundreds of blacks while calling for racial harmony. Remember that American pigs have already dropped more bombs on a piece of land about the size of Florida than the entire tonnage dropped during World War II. Don't be tricked by talk. Arm yourselves and shoot to live.
طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. In our political discourse these days, we constantly hear that at the base of the conflict in the Middle East is the clash of civilizations. This theory, espoused by Harvard professors Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington in essays and books, claims that at the heart of the conflict is the fundamental difference between Eastern and Western cultures and values, and of course argues for the superiority of Western civilization. At the base of the Islamophobia and anti-Arab speech in the media and at the center of so much of our vitriolic political discourse these days is the emphasis of our cultural differences, and that we must dominate those inferior cultures lest they somehow take us over. It is us or them, and this poisonous analysis can only lead to war, and has. It is the clash of civilizations mantra, and it is everywhere in our political discourse these days. Our feature presentation this morning offers a different vision. However, it was given 18 years ago, in 1998, by the late Columbia professor Edward Said in a lecture at the University of Massachusetts. He challenges what he calls the myth of the clash of civilizations. And if only we had listened to him and sought to emphasize the commonality of our civilizations as well as the differences. Edward Said, perhaps the leading Palestinian intellectual of his time, died in 2003, but his prophetic voice offers special relevance in the current political scene, and that is why it is our feature presentation this morning. Here is Professor Edward Said speaking on the myth of the clash of civilizations.
I'm going to start, in fact, talk throughout about an essay and a book written by Samuel Huntington entitled The Clash of Civilizations. When it first appeared in 1993 in the journal Foreign Affairs, it had a question mark after it. And it announced in its first sentence that world politics is entering a new phase. 3 years later, Huntington expanded the essay, some would say bloated it, to the size of a book without a question mark. The new book, which was published last year, entitled The Clash of Civilization and the Emerging World Order. My premise is that the essay is better than the book. I mean, it got worse the more he added to it. So I'll concentrate most of my attention on the essay, but make some comments about the book as we go along. Now, what Huntington meant when he said that world politics is entering a new phase was that whereas in the recent past world conflicts had been between ideological camps, grouping the first, second, and third worlds into warring entities. The new style of politics, which he discerned, would entail conflicts between different and presumably clashing civilizations. I quote him, "The great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of conflict will be cultural. The clash of civilizations will dominate global politics." Later, he explains how it is that the principal clash will be between Western and non-Western civilization. But he spends most of his time in the two works discussing the disagreements, potential or actual, between what he calls the West, on the one hand, and on the other, Islamic and Confucian civilizations. In terms of detail, a great deal more attention, hostile attention, is paid to Islam than to any other civilization, including the West. Now, much of the tremendous interest subsequently taken in Huntington's essay, I think, derives from its timing rather than exclusively from what it says. As he himself notes, there have been several intellectual and political attempts since the end of the Cold War to map the emerging world situation, and this includes Francis Fukuyama's thesis on the end of history, which nobody talks about, sort of the end of Fukuyama, really, and the thesis put about during the latter days of the Bush administration, the theory of the so-called New World Order. But there have been more serious attempts to deal with the coming millennium in works by Paul Kennedy, for example, Eric Hobsbawm, less interesting and more rabid, Connor Cruz O'Brien, Robert Kaplan, and a book that's apparently making the rounds in campuses on Jihad versus McWorld by Benjamin Barber. All of these books have done so, have looked at the coming millennium with considerable attention to the causes of future conflict, which has given them all, I think justly, cause for alarm. The core of Huntington's vision, which is not really original with him, is the idea of an unceasing clash, a concept of conflict which slides somewhat effortlessly into the political space vacated by the unremitting war of ideas and values embodied in the unregretted Cold War, of which, of course, Huntington was a great theorist. I don't think, therefore, it's inaccurate to suggest that what Huntington is providing in his work, especially since it's primarily addressed to influential opinion and policymakers, is, in fact, a recycled version of the Cold War thesis that that conflicts in today's and tomorrow's world will remain not economic or social in essence, but ideological. And if that is so, then one ideology, the West's, is the still point or the locus around which, for Huntington, all other civilizations turn. In effect, then, the Cold War continues, but this time on many fronts, with many more serious and basic systems of values and ideas, like Islam and Confucianism, struggling for ascendancy and even dominance over the West. Not surprisingly, therefore, Huntington concludes his essay with a brief survey, not only his essay but his book as well, with a survey of what it is that the West might do, must do, to remain strong and keep its opponents, weak and divided. He says, "The West must exploit differences and conflicts," I'm quoting now, "and conflicts among Confucian and Islamic states to support in other civilizations groups sympathetic to Western values and interests, to strengthen international institutions that reflect and legitimate Western interests and values, and to promote the involvement of non-Western states in those institutions." Now, it's a very interventionist and quite aggressive attitude towards other civilizations to get them to be more Western. So strong and insistent is Huntington's notion that other civilizations necessarily clash with the West, and so relentlessly aggressive and chauvinistic is his prescription for what the West must do to continue winning, so that the reader's forced to conclude that he's really most interested in continuing and expanding the Cold War by other means rather than advancing ideas that might help us to understand the current world scene or ideas that would try to reconcile between cultures. Not only will conflict continue, but he says, the conflict between civilizations will be the latest phase in the evolution of conflict in the modern world. It says, a very brief and rather crudely articulated manual in the art of maintaining a wartime status in the minds of Americans and others, that Huntington's work has to be now understood. I go so far as saying that it argues from the standpoint of Pentagon planners and defense industry executives who may have temporarily lost their occupations after the end of the Cold War but have now discovered a new vocation for themselves. But perhaps because Huntington is more interested in policy prescriptions than he is either in history or in the careful analysis of cultures, Huntington, in my opinion, is quite misleading in what he says and how he puts things. A great deal of his argument, first of all, depends on second and third-hand opinion that scants the enormous advances in our concrete understanding and theoretical understanding of how cultures work, how they change, and how they can best be grasped or apprehended. A brief look at the people and opinions he quotes suggests that journalism and popular demagoguery are his main sources rather than serious scholarship or theory. When you draw on tendentious publicists and scholars, you already prejudice the argument in favor of conflict and polemic rather than in favor of true understanding and the kind of cooperation between peoples that our planet needs. Huntington's authorities are not the cultures themselves, but a small handful of authorities picked by him because, in fact, they emphasize the latent bellicosity in one or another statement by one or another so-called spokesperson for about that culture. The giveaway for me is the title of his book and his essay, The Clash of Civilizations, which is not his phrase, but Bernard Lewis's. On the last page of Lewis's essay, entitled The Roots of Muslim Rage, which appeared in the September 1990 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Lewis speaks about the current problem with the Islamic world. I quote, "This is incredible stuff. It should by now be clear," Lewis says, "that we are facing a mood and a movement in Islam, far transcending the level of issues and policies and the governments that pursue them. This is no less than a clash of civilizations. The perhaps irrational, but surely historic receptions of an ancient rival against our," whenever you hear the word our, you want to head for the exit, "against our Judeo-Christian heritage, our secular present, and the worldwide expansion of both. It is crucially important that we, on our side, should not be provoked into an equally historic but also equally irrational reaction against that rival." In other words, we shouldn't be as crazy as they are. And, of course, Lewis is very much listened to at the Council of Foreign Relations, the New York Review of Books, and so on and so forth. But few people today with any sense would want to volunteer such sweeping characterizations as the ones advanced by Lewis about a billion Muslims scattered through five continents, dozens of differing languages and traditions and histories. Of them all, Lewis says that they are all enraged at Western modernity, as if a billion people were really only one person and Western civilization was no more complicated a matter than a simple declarative sentence. But what I do want to stress is, first of all, how Huntington has picked up from Lewis in a classical kind of Orientalist gesture the notion that civilizations are monolithic and homogeneous. And second, how, again from Lewis, he assumes the unchanging character of the duality between us and them. In other words, I think it's absolutely imperative to stress that, like Lewis, Huntington doesn't write neutral, descriptive, and objective prose, but is himself a polemicist whose rhetoric not only depends heavily on prior arguments about a war of all against all, but in effect perpetuates them. Far from being an arbiter between civilizations, which is what he suggests he might be doing, Huntington is a partisan, an advocate of one civilization over all the others. Like Lewis, Huntington defines Islamic civilization reductively, as if what most matters about it is its supposed anti-Westernism. I mean, it doesn't matter to him that Muslims have other things to do than to think about the West with hatred. But you get the impression that that's all they're thinking about, is how to destroy the West, bomb it, and, you know, destroy the whole world, really. For his part, Lewis tries to give a set of reasons for his definition that Islam has never modernized, that it never separated between church and state, that it has been incapable of understanding other civilization, all of them, you know, complete untruths. I mean, of course, the Arabs, Muslims have traveled well before the Europeans in the East, in Africa, and in Europe, and were great discoverers of other civilization well before Marco Polo and Columbus. But Huntington doesn't bother with any of this. For him, Islam, Confucianism, and the other five or six civilizations, Hindu, Japanese, Slavic Orthodox, Latin American, and African, that still exist, are separate from each other, and consequently, potentially in a conflict which he wants to manage, not resolve. He writes, therefore, as a crisis manager, not as a student of cultures and civilizations, nor as a reconciler between them. At the core, and this is what has made his work strike so responsive a chord among post-Cold War policymakers, is this sense that you saw in, crisis managing prose during the Vietnam War, this sense of cutting through a lot of unnecessary details. You go through masses of scholarship and huge amounts of experience, and you boil all of it down to a couple of catchy, easy to quote and remember ideas, which are then passed off as pragmatic, hard-headed, practical, sensible, clear. But is this, and now I come to the more serious part of what I have to say, is this the best way to understand the world we live in? Is it wise to produce a simplified map of the world and then hand it to generals and civilian lawmakers as a prescription for first comprehending and then acting in the world? Doesn't this, in effect, prolong and deepen conflict? What does it do to minimize civilizational conflict? Do we want the clash of civilizations? Doesn't it mobilize nationalist passions and therefore nationalist murderousness? Shouldn't we be asking the question, why is one doing this sort of thing? To understand or to act? To mitigate or to aggravate the likelihood of conflict? I'd want to begin to survey the world situation by commenting on how prevalent it has become for people to speak now in the name of large and, in my opinion, undesirably vague and manipulable abstractions like the West or Japanese culture or Slavic culture or Islam or Confucianism, labels that collapse particular religions, races, and ethnicities into ideologies that are considerably more unpleasant and provocative than Gobineau and Renan did 150 years ago. Let me give a couple of examples to illustrate what I mean. The language of group identity makes a particularly strident appearance from the middle to the end of the 19th century as the culmination of decades of international competition between the great European and American powers for territories in Africa and Asia. In the battle for the empty spaces of Africa, the so-called Dark Continent, France and Britain, Germany, Belgium, Portugal, resort not only to force, but to a whole slew of theories and rhetorics for justifying their plunder. Perhaps the most famous of such devices is the French notion of the civilizing mission, la mission civilisatrice, a notion underlying which is the idea that some races and cultures have a higher aim in life than others. This gives the more powerful, the more developed, the more civilized, the higher, the right to colonize others, not in the name of brute force or plunder, both of which are standard components of the exercise, but in the name of a noble ideal. Conrad's most famous story, The Heart of Darkness, is an ironic, even terrifying enactment of this thesis that, as the narrator puts it, the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can bow down before and sacrifice to. In response to this sort of logic, two things occur. One is that competing imperial powers invent their own theory of cultural destiny in order to justify their actions abroad. Britain had such a theory, Germany had one, Belgium had one, and of course in the concept of manifest destiny, the United States had one too. These redeeming ideas dignify the practice of competition and clash, whose real purpose, as Conrad quite accurately saw, was self-aggrandizement, power, conquest, treasure, and unrestrained self-pride. I'd go so far as to say that what we today call the politics or the rhetoric of identity, by which a member of one ethnic or religious or national or cultural group puts that group at the center of the world, derives from that period of imperial competition at the end of the last century. And this, in turn, provokes the concept of worlds at war that quite obviously is at the heart of Huntington's article. In the related fields of political economy, geography, anthropology, and historiography, the theory that each world is self-enclosed, has its own boundaries and special territory, is applied to the world map, to the structure of civilizations, to the notion that each race has a special destiny, a psychology, and an ethos. Renan said, for example, that the Chinese race, its destiny is to serve. They are a docile people, and they must serve. The black race must be the bearers, the laborers of mankind, because they're strong in physique and can work hard. That kind of... All of these ideas, almost without exception, are based not on the harmony, but on the clash or conflict between worlds. The second thing that happens is that the lesser peoples, the objects of the imperial gaze, so to speak, respond by resisting their forcible manipulation and settlement. We now know that active resistance to the white man began the moment he set foot in places like Algeria, East Africa, India, and elsewhere. Later, primary resistance was succeeded by secondary resistance, the organization of political and cultural movements determined to achieve independence and liberation from imperial control. At precisely the moment in the 19th century that among the European and American powers a rhetoric of cultural self-justification begins to be widespread, a responding rhetoric among the colonized people develops, one that speaks in terms of African or Asian or Arab or Muslim unity, independence, self-determination. In India, for example, the Congress Party was organized in 1880, and by the turn of the century had convinced the Indian elite that only by supporting Indian languages, industry and commerce could political freedom come. These are ours and ours alone, runs the argument, and only by supporting our world against theirs, note the us versus them construction, can we finally stand on our own. One finds a similar logic at work during the Meiji period in modern Japan. Something like this rhetoric of belonging is also lodged at the heart of each independence movement's nationalism. And it achieved the result shortly after World War II, not only of dismantling over a period of about 20 years the classical empires, but of winning independence for dozens of countries thereafter. India, Indonesia, most of the Arab countries, Indochina, Algeria, Kenya, etc. All these emerged onto the world scene, sometimes peacefully, sometimes as the effect of internal developments, as in the Japanese instance, or of ugly colonial wars and wars of national liberation. In both the colonial and post-colonial context, therefore, rhetorics of general cultural or civilizational specificity went in two potential directions. One, a utopian line that insisted on an overall pattern of integration and harmony between all peoples. The other, a line that suggested as to how all cultures were so specific and jealous as to reject and war against all the others. Among instances of the utopian are the language and institutions of the United Nations, founded in the aftermath of World War II, and the subsequent development out of that of various attempts at world government, predicated on coexistence, voluntary limitations of sovereignty, the integration of peoples and cultures harmoniously. Among the second are the theory and practice of the Cold War, and more recently the idea of the clash of civilizations, which appears to be a necessity for a world of so many parts and indeed even a certainty. According to this, cultures and civilizations are basically separated from each other. That is to say, the core of Islam is to be separated from everything else. The core of the West is to be separated from all the others. I don't want to be invidious here. In the Islamic world, there has been a resurgence of rhetoric and movements stressing the innate opposition between Islam and the West. Just as in Africa, Europe, Asia, and elsewhere, movements have appeared that stress the need for excluding or exterminating, as in Bosnia, others as undesirable. White apartheid in South Africa was such a movement, as is the Zionist idea that Palestine should be for the Jews only and that Palestinians as non-Jews should have a lesser place. Afrocentricity, Islamocentricity, are movements that also stress the independence and separateness of cultures. Within each civilizational camp, we will notice there are official representatives of that culture who make themselves into its mouthpiece, who assign themselves the role of articulating our, or for that matter, their essence. This always requires compression, reduction, exaggeration. So on the first and most immediate level, then, statements about what our culture is, civilization is, or ought to be, necessarily involves a contest over the definition. That's why I think it's more accurate to say that the period we're living in is not the clash of civilization, but the clash of definitions. Anyone who has the slightest understanding of how cultures really work knows that defining the culture, saying what it is for members of that culture, is always a major, and even in undemocratic societies, an ongoing contest. There are canonical authorities to be selected, regularly revised, debated, selected, dismissed. There are ideas of good and evil, belonging or not belonging, hierarchies of values to be specified, discussed, rediscussed. Each culture, moreover, defines its enemies, what stands beyond it and threatens it, an other to be despised and fought against. But cultures are not the same. There is an official culture, the culture of priests, academics, and the state. It provides definitions of patriotism, loyalty, boundaries, and what I've called belonging. It is this official culture that speaks in the name of the whole. But it's also true, and this is completely missing from the clash of civilization argument as we hear it in Huntington, in addition to the mainstream or official culture, there are dissenting or alternative, unorthodox, heterodox strands that contain many anti-authoritarian themes in them that are in competition with the official culture. These can be called the counterculture, an ensemble of practices associated with various kinds of outsiders, the poor, immigrants, artistic bohemians, workers, rebels, artists. From the counterculture comes the critique of authority and attacks on what is official and orthodox. No culture is understandable without some sense of this ever-present source of creative provocation from the unofficial to the official. To disregard the sense of restlessness in the West, in Islam, in Confucianism, within each culture, and to assume that there's complete homogeneity between culture and identity is to miss what is vital and fertile in culture. A couple of years ago, Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book called The Disuniting of America, which is a kind of cri de cœur about the way in which American history, which for him is the history of Bancroft and Adams and so on, is dissolving into something quite different. And he says that new groups in American society want the writing of history to reflect not only an America that was conceived of and ruled by patricians and landowners, but an America in which slaves, servants, laborers, and poor immigrants played an important but as yet unacknowledged role. The narratives of such people, silenced by the great discourses whose source was Washington, the investment banks of New York, the universities of New England, and the great industrial fortunes of the Middle and Far West, have come to disrupt the slow progress and unruffled serenity of the official story. They ask questions, interject the experience of social unfortunates, and make the claims of lesser peoples, of women, Asian and African Americans, and various other minorities, sexual as well as ethnic. There's a similar debate inside the Islamic world today, which in the often hysterical outcry about the threat of Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, and terrorism that one encounters so often in the media, is often lost sight of completely. Like any other major world culture, Islam contains within itself an astonishing variety of currents and countercurrents. I would say that it is this extremely widespread attitude of questioning and skepticism towards age-old authority that characterizes the post-war world in both East and West. And it's that Huntington cannot handle and therefore resorts to the business of the clash of cultures and the clash of civilizations. Two theorists of that sort, civilization identity is a stable and undisturbed thing, like a room full of furniture at the back of your house. This is extremely far from the truth, not just in the Islamic world, but throughout the entire surface of the globe. To emphasize the differences between cultures is completely to ignore the literally unending debate about defining the culture or civilization within those civilizations, including Western ones. These debates completely undermine any idea of a fixed identity, and hence of relationships between identities, what Huntington considers to be a sort of ontological fact of political existence, to wit, the clash of civilizations. Too much attention paid to managing and clarifying the clash of cultures obliterates something else. The fact of a great, often silent exchange and dialogue between them. What culture today, whether Japanese, Arab, European, Korean, Chinese, Indian, has not had long, intimate, and extraordinarily rich contacts with other cultures? There is no exception to this exchange at all. Much the same is true of literature, where readers, for example, of García Márquez, Naguib Mahfouz, Kenzaburo Oe, exist far beyond the national or cultural boundaries imposed by language and nation. In my own field of comparative literature, there's a commitment to the relationships between literatures as to their reconciliation and harmony despite the existence of powerful ideological and national barriers between them. And this sort of cooperative, collective enterprise is what one misses in the proclaimers of an undying clash between cultures. The lifelong dedication that has existed in all modern and ancient societies among scholars, artists, musicians, visionaries, and prophets to try to come to terms with the other, with that other society or culture that seems so foreign and so distant. It seems to me that unless we emphasize and maximize the spirit of cooperation and humanistic exchange, and here I don't speak simply of uninformed delight or amateurish enthusiasm for the exotic, but rather profound existential commitment and labor on behalf of the other, unless we do that, we are going to end up superficially and stridently banging the drum for our culture in opposition to all the others. And we know also in another very important study of the way cultures work, the book co-authored or co-edited by Terence Ranger and Eric Hobsbawm, that even tradition can be invented. I mean, the idea of a culture and a civilization being something that's stable and fixed is completely disproved by this notion of how traditions can be invented, manufactured for the occasion. So the traditions are really not the wonderfully stable things that we are, but rather abstractions that can quite easily be created and destroyed, manipulated, and so on. As I've argued in several of my own works, in today's Europe and the United States, what is described as Islam, for instance, because this is where the burden, I think, of Clash of Civilizations thesis goes. What is described as Islam belongs to the discourse of Orientalism, a construction fabricated to whip up feelings of hostility and antipathy against a part of the world that happens to be of strategic importance for its oil, its threatening adjacence to Christianity, its formidable history of competition with the West. Yet this is a very different thing than what, to Muslims who live within its domain, Islam really is. There's a world of difference between Islam in Indonesia and Islam in Egypt. By the same token, the volatility of today's struggle over the meaning and definition of Islam is evident. In Egypt, where the secular powers of society are in conflict with various Islamic protest movements and reformers over the nature of Islam, and in such circumstances, the easiest and the least accurate thing is to say, that is the world of Islam, and see how it is all terrorists and fundamentalists, and see also how different, how irrational they are compared to us. But the truly weakest part, and I conclude here, or the weakest part of the clash of cultures and civilizations thesis is the rigid separation assumed between them, despite the overwhelming evidence that today's world is in fact a world of mixtures, of migrations, and of crossings over, of boundaries traversed. One of the major crises affecting countries like France, Britain, and the US has been brought about by the realization, now dawning everywhere, that no culture or society is purely one thing. Sizable minorities, North Africans in France, the African, Caribbean, and Indian populations in Britain, Asian and African elements in this country, dispute the idea that civilization that prided themselves on being homogeneous can continue to do so. There are no insulated cultures or civilizations. Any attempt made to separate them into the watertight compartments alleged by Huntington and his ilk does damage to their variety, their diversity, their sheer complexity of elements, their radical hybridity. The more insistent we are on the separation of cultures, the more inaccurate we are about ourselves and about others. The notion of an exclusionary civilization is, to my way of thinking, an impossible one. The real question, then, is whether in the end we want to work for civilizations that are separate, or whether we should be taking the more integrative, but perhaps more difficult path, which is to try to see them as making one vast whole whose exact contours are impossible for any person to grasp, but whose certain existence we can intuit and feel and study. In view of the depressing actualities around us, the presence of many intercultural, inter-ethnic conflicts, it does seem to me ostrich-like to suggest that we in Europe and the US should maintain our civilization, which Huntington calls the West, by holding everyone and all the others at bay, increasing the rifts between peoples in order to prolong our dominance. That is, in effect, what he argues, and one can quite easily understand why it is that his essay was published in Foreign Affairs and why so many policymakers have drifted toward it as allowing the US to extend the mindset of the Cold War into a different time and for a new audience. Much more productive and useful is a new global mentality or consciousness that sees the dangers we face from the standpoint of the whole human race. These dangers include the pauperization of most of the globe's population, the emergence of virulent local, national, ethnic, and religious sentiment, as in Bosnia, Rwanda, Lebanon, Chechnya, and elsewhere, the decline of literacy and onset of a new illiteracy based on electronic modes of communication, television, and the new information global superhighway, the fragmentation and threatened disappearance of the grand narratives of emancipation and enlightenment. Our most precious asset in the face of such a dire transformation of history is the emergence, not of a sense of class, but a sense of community, understanding, sympathy, and hope, which is the direct opposite of what Huntington provokes. If I may quote some lines by the great Martinican poet, Aimé Césaire, that I used in my book on culture and imperialism, and I never tire of quoting these lines, and he speaks here of man, l'homme in French. But the work of man is only just beginning, and it remains to conquer all the violence entrenched in the recesses of our passion. And no race possesses the monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of force, and there's a place for all at the rendezvous of victory. In what they imply, these sentiments prepare the way for a dissolution of cultural barriers as a kind of blockage between cultures, as well as of the pride that prevents the kind of benign globalism already to be found, for instance, in the environmental movement in scientific cooperation, in the women's movement, in the universal concern for human rights, in concepts of global thought that stress community and sharing over racial, gender, or class dominance. It would seem to me, therefore, that efforts to return the community of civilizations to a primitive stage of narcissistic struggle needs to be understood not as descriptions about how, in fact, civilizations behave, but rather as incitements to wasteful conflict and unedifying chauvinism. And that seems to be exactly what we don't need. Thank you.
You have been listening to Columbia University Professor Edward Said speaking in 1998 on the myth of the clash of civilizations. The lecture was followed by a question and answer period, and I want to include one of the answers Professor Said gave, even though it is obviously dated. In listening to this answer, remember that it is given only 4 years after the Oslo agreements were signed, Arafat was still alive, and the wall had not even been started. Yet there is a relevance to this question that I felt needed to be included in Said's presentation. The question was, how do these ideas of coexistence relate to the question of Palestine? Here is Edward Said's answer.
No, I think that the situation of the Palestinians is at this moment really quite, well, it's verging on the catastrophic, I'd say. I mean, it's not a happy moment. Not only is there really a quite crazy, in my opinion, well, egregious is the word I sometimes use for Netanyahu, but I mean, he's a bloody, I mean, there's something quite bloodthirsty about him. And this is the head of the, as Mr. Arafat calls them, our peace partners, on the one hand. And on the other, you have the United States pretty much backing Israel. I mean, there are a few bleats here and there from Albright and a couple of others saying, well, please, time out on the settlements. I mean, the suggestion being, if you count to 10, and during the count of 10, you don't build any settlements, you're somehow being a nice guy. And then after 10, you can build all the settlements you want, which is the theory, I think. And supplying Israel with billions of dollars a year. They say $3 billion. There was a letter in the Times yesterday exactly about that. Say, why don't we say something to them about it? We keep on punishing the Palestinians. We withhold $100 million of aid. And here, for the Palestinians, because they're not fighting terrorism enough, which means pretty much lock everybody up. So why don't we withhold some of the aid to Israel? That was the question. I think it's a very good question. It's never asked. And then, I mean, it's a catalog of woes, and then you know we're at a moment in our history as Palestinians that we are led by, I don't know, words fail me, I don't know what we're led by, but not a very bright leadership, you know, going from one mistake after another without and there's a kind of natural thing that occurs amongst most people that in times of trouble you don't want to change horses in midstream. I mean, and there's a leader, and we're beset on all sides. We can't move. The refugees have no passports. They're unable to work. They're unable to travel. You know, there's 7 million Palestinians in the world today, more or less, facing the same problems, some obviously worse than others. And the people on the West Bank and Gaza have lost, you know, 50% of their income over the last 4 years since the peace process began. And unemployment is up to anywhere between, you know, 30% and 60%. And houses are constantly being destroyed, and property is taken from Palestinians, and new settlements are being built in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is being Judaized. I mean, so in all of this, it's very difficult to say that there's much brightness on the horizon. I think it's a particularly bad period, which I'm afraid will get worse, because the leadership is very shaky. Arafat has very little popularity now for obvious reasons. I mean, he hasn't delivered anything except problems, and he keeps rounding people up, as the Israelis tell him to do. And his men in Washington keep on conceding more to the Israelis, agreeing to more humiliating terms. And I think the main problem, and I think this will probably help a great deal in the near future, will be the clarification of what it is that we're all about. I mean, you know, for years we used to say that we want to liberate Palestine, and then we say we want to liberate a part of Palestine, then we want sovereignty on that. Then we accept autonomy on that. We don't even get that. So the horizon keeps shrinking, and people don't know what the whole struggle is all about. And until that is made clear, unless there's some kind of consensus, which is bound to arise at some point, I think our situation will get worse. And finally, you know, it's been my, Iqbal shares the same, I think, view. It's been our view that, you know, that the United States plays an extremely important role. And I think the view of most people, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, citizens like ourselves, is that the situation in the Middle East, especially with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, is simply unacceptable. I mean, this is, you know, the most extraordinary kind of flouting of the rules of international and even national behavior. Collective punishment is the order of the day. People are killed all the time. And, you know, the idea is that Israel can do this and we can continue to pay for it. So what I've been surprised by is the absence of a movement in this country of people who are willing to take this quite important issue. And it's a movement, I think, that a lot of Jews have to be involved in it. I don't think it's a sign. I mean, I know it's Rosh Hashanah, so I don't think it's... But it's not something that you can turn your head away from, because this is done in the name of the Jewish people. And I think it's a quite important political and historical struggle. And at the bottom is a question of fairness and justice. Not of the United States, but of the, you know, of the future of these two peoples who have to in some way share Palestine. But I think the role of the United States and the United States citizenry is absolutely central. Raise consciousness and asking questions and not allowing these things to happen in the name of the West and the great and the good and the beautiful without demur. And I think, if I might just say one more thing to my Jewish friends, that I think the crisis is a crisis of conscience. That is to say, until there's a widespread recognition and acknowledgement of what Israel cost the Palestinians, and that the present identity of Israel today is fundamentally intertwined with the tragedy of the Palestinians, one caused by the other, there will never be peace, because you can't continue to sweep away the fact that Israel was constructed on the ruins of another society and by the mass dispossession of another people who remain unacknowledged as just sort of obscure natives in the background, back to the desert, let them go to one of the other Arab countries. That's been the position. The Oslo Accords say specifically that Israel bears no responsibility for the costs of the occupation. This after 26 years of military occupation, no responsibility. As an Israeli journalist said, he said, we took over the country in 1948 from the British. The British left us the port of Haifa, a road system, an electrical system, a large number of municipal buildings, and lots of prisons. And we could build Israel. Without that, there would be no state today. If we had taken Palestine in 1948 the way we left Gaza for the Palestinians, there would be no Israel. We destroyed the economy. We deported most of the capable people. We forced the people to live in hovels and refugee camps over a period. I mean, if anybody's been to Gaza, it's one of the most criminal places on earth because of Israeli policy of occupation. And they bear no responsibility for it. I mean, that's simply unacceptable, even for the Jewish people who have suffered so much. It's unacceptable. You cannot continue to victimize somebody else just because you yourself were a victim once. There has to be a limit.
That was Professor Edward Said speaking at the University of Massachusetts on the myth of the clash of civilizations in 1998.
يا You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
You're listening to episode 733 of Unwelcome Guests, The MENA Connection. I'm Robin Upton, and we continue our look at the bloodstained history of the US Deep State. This week it's a one-piece production. This is a two-and-a-bit-hour video that I've condensed to 2 hours. It's produced by Terry Reid, who features centrally in it. So we're only hearing one side of the story. The government doesn't really appear to have done much in the way of actual denial, as per Gary Webb. I think they're following a policy of trying to ignore it. I've made a Wiki Spooks page. This is all pretty sparsely reported on Wikipedia, which of course doesn't admit the reality of CIA involvement in drug dealing, so it would be hard for them to document very much of this. I feel I've got more to tell you. On the other hand, I'm going to let the video speak for itself. If you'd like to watch the whole thing, then I shall link to a YouTube from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/733.
On October the 7th, 1994, Sarah McClendon, the senior White House news correspondent who has covered 11 presidential administrations, beginning with that of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, demonstrated once again that she has the courage to ask the hardball questions other journalists only dare to think. As she confronted William Jefferson Clinton about the Central Intelligence Agency's involvement in nefarious activities, activities set at a remote airport in western Arkansas while Clinton was Arkansas's commander-in-chief, she finally cornered the man who was a co-conspirator in bypassing the Constitution of the United States of America. In doing so, the president was not only forced to address the looming scandal that may impeach him, Clinton once again demonstrated his trademark talent. He lied.
Sir, the Republicans are trying to blame you for the existence of a small air base at MENA, Arkansas. This base was set up by George Bush and Oliver North and the CIA to help the Iran-Contras, and they brought in plane load after plane load of cocaine there for sale in the United States, and then they took the money and bought weapons and took them back to the Contras, all of which was illegal, as you know, under the Boland Act. But tell me, did they tell you that this had to be in existence because of national security?
Well, let me answer the question. No, they didn't tell me anything about it. They didn't say anything to me about it. The airport in question and all the events in question were the subject of state and federal inquiries. It was primarily a matter for federal jurisdiction. The state really had next to nothing to do with it. The local prosecutor did conduct an investigation based on what was within the jurisdiction of state law. The rest of it was under jurisdiction of the United States attorneys who were appointed successively by previous administrations. We had nothing, zero, to do with it, and everybody who's ever looked into it knows that.
Holt County Prosecutor Charles Blake, the man who initially attempted to investigate the MENA, Arkansas criminal activities, would surely take exception to Mr. Clinton's assertion that, quote, the local prosecutor did conduct an investigation based on what was within the jurisdiction of the state law, end quote. In fact, it was Blake who went directly to then-Governor Clinton to seek funding for his investigation, seeing as how rural Polk County lacked the financial resources to deal with the CIA.
When it became apparent that nothing was going to be done on the federal level, that's when I began more actively pursuing it.
Prosecutor Blake, a Clinton supporter, met with the governor and handed him a letter requesting money for a state grand jury on MENA.
His response to me was that he would get a man, something to the effect that he would get a man on it and would get word back to me. And I never heard back.
Years later, Clinton said he offered $25,000 to Prosecutor Black's boss to fund a grand jury. But Charles Black and his boss claim they never heard about any offer of money from Governor Clinton.
I believe Bill Clinton's an honest, respectable man, and I have to believe that he did that. But the fact is, I never got that word myself.
Black wasn't the only man affected by uncooperative superiors who, for some strange reason, seemed willing to turn a blind eye to blatant disregard for America's laws. William Duncan, a senior IRS Criminal Intelligence Division investigator, was running headlong into invisible walls that were protecting what appeared to be an open wound in the Department of Justice.
How far will the United States government go to protect an operation? Will they kill a case? I think history has shown that that can happen.
Did it happen?
In my opinion, yes.
Duncan, through the Arkansas Attorney General's office, desperately sought funding to continue his investigation into the dark corners of the CIA's activities in Arkansas. But just as Prosecutor Black had earlier experienced, Bill Clinton wouldn't help. The purse strings funding justice were drawn tight. So Clinton's response to Sarah McClendon about, quote, the state really had next to nothing to do with it, end quote, was another lie. The state, under Clinton's control, helped seal the fate of the MENA scandal by not funding a proper investigation. Even more shocking, when law enforcement failed to shield the citizens of Arkansas from the federal government's reckless disregard for the sovereignty of the state and its laws, a citizens group known as the Arkansas Committee gathered thousands of signatures and went directly to Clinton, demanding he lead the investigation. The results of the civilian effort? Continued lies, deceit, and cover-up. What forces could be responsible for compromising the entire system of justice? Bill Clinton certainly knows. He was the governor of Arkansas who allowed the subversion of his state government by the shadowy forces radiating from the Reagan-Bush White House when ex-CIA Director William Casey began using the CIA to illegally conduct secret foreign policy. This serious breach of America's constitutional authority was labeled by the media as Iran-Contra. This documentary will rewrite this dark period in American history and leave you with a gnawing question. Who or what is running this country? Gun running. Mysterious CIA flights. Contra military training. Guerrilla pilot training. Clandestine airdrops. Tons of illegal drugs. Millions of dollars in dirty money. Covert activity in some third world banana republic, right? Wrong. Arkansas, America's own banana republic.
The cost of living an exciting life is high. You can't sit in Baton Rouge and go to work from 9 to 5 on Monday through Friday and go to the LSU football games on Saturday night and church on Sunday morning and have an exciting life. That may be exciting to 99% of the population, but to me it's not. And the exciting thing in life to me is to get into a life-threatening situation. Now that's excitement.
That was the voice of the late Adler Berryman Seal, pilot extraordinaire, soldier of fortune, drug smuggler, undercover agent for the FBI, DEA, U.S. Customs, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Barry Seal, who was ruthlessly assassinated in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in February 1986, plays a pivotal role, along with his C-123K military transport plane he affectionately named the Fat Lady, in chronicling the true history of Iran-Contra. This story is about unmasking the deception that was perpetuated upon the American people at a time in the mid-1980s when a small backward state, Arkansas, became the epicenter of a CIA-black operation designed to do an end run around congressional law. A black operation being backdoored out of the Reagan-Bush White House and set in place in rural western Arkansas under the watchful eyes of then-Governor William Jefferson Clinton. We will expose the ongoing cover-up, which has now spanned three presidential administrations, a cover-up designed to keep the American people in the dark about the unthinkable. that trafficking in cocaine is justified in the pursuit of national security and foreign policy. This documentary is presented from two unique perspectives, from the outside through the eyes of numerous journalists, news organizations, and researchers constituting more than an eight-year effort to get to the truth surrounding the CIA's use of Western Arkansas as a staging area for deniable covert activities, and told from the inside through a man who survived the MENA connection and who now, at great personal risk, is willing to set the record straight about the inner workings of the CIA's off-the-shelf, self-sustaining, standalone project known as the Enterprise. This intelligence insider, Terry Reed, has written a best-selling book, Compromised, Clinton, Bush, and the CIA, detailing the inner workings of Ronald Reagan's backdoor foreign policy, mislabeled Iran-Contra by the media. Terry will join us later in this documentary to lead us through this maze of deceit that was the brainchild of George Herbert Walker Bush and which compromised Bill Clinton. So what were Barry Seal's CIA-assigned tasks at MENA? First, the Contras needed guns. Arkansas's National Guard armories had most of the component parts and inventory from which to build guns. All that was lacking was to enlist the manufacturing services of a small clandestine group of trusted Arkansas manufacturing companies, and the recipe would be complete. They would build the critical gun parts that, by law, produce a paper trail from the manufacturer to the end user. Only in this case, per CIA instructions, there would be no serial number stamped into the parts and no documentation created to leave an embarrassing trail. Untraceable weapons would seemingly appear from nowhere, and Barry Seal would then fly the munitions to staging areas in Central America with the help of his CIA-provided C-123 cargo plane, the Fat Lady, which had a gross weight capability of 60,000 pounds. Second, the Contras needed skilled pilots, pilots trained in the risky and often deadly business of flying slow and heavily laden cargo planes behind enemy lines for the purpose of resupplying the Contra soldiers on the ground in Nicaragua. As we had learned in Vietnam, guerrilla warfare depends upon a continuous supply of munitions, medical supplies, and food being provided to the foot soldier on the ground. The CIA's Enterprise, based in Honduras, had already procured the planes, planes such as the C-123 Provider and the C-7 Caribou. But potentially catastrophic risks were being taken by piloting the planes with American crews. If an accident or a shootdown did occur, the CIA would have built-in deniability if the planes were piloted by Nicaraguan nationals who were simply trying to liberate their country from the jaws of communism. Being an FAA-certified flight instructor, Terry Reed's role with respect to the Contra pilot training was to train the students in multi-engine low-level operations, giving special emphasis to aerial cargo delivery techniques at night while in hostile fire environments. Third, Seal was tasked with flying the necessary cash back to Arkansas to sustain the operation. All of the sources of Seal's cash are not yet known. However, a large amount has been traced to the Drug Enforcement Administration in Florida. It appears the DEA was funding the MENA operation with cash seized during drug raids.
Were there Contras who relied on the profits of narcotics in order to buy arms and to survive? Yes.
It is easy to see how the entire MENA enterprise could evolve into ex-CIA Director Bill Casey's mandate to develop an
off-the-shelf, self-sustaining, standalone entity that could perform certain activities on behalf of the United States.
But what developed as a result of Barry Seal building the machinery to launder unauthorized government money will likely emerge as a money laundering scandal, the likes of which this country has never seen. Back in the summer of 1987, a young television journalist named Teresa Dickey was covering Western Arkansas for Channel 5 out of Fort Smith, a city located 100 miles north of MENA. Well, Miss Dickey had discovered something very strange indeed was or had been going on in and around the MENA airport. Years earlier, the townspeople of MENA had welcomed with open arms and much fanfare the arrival of huge military C-130 aircraft. This was perceived as a boom for the rural MENA economy. Little did the townspeople realize, the Central Intelligence Agency had just selected MENA as the staging area for an unauthorized clandestine operation. Initially, Dickey thought that perhaps she was witnessing the results of then-Governor Bill Clinton's aggressive industry recruitment program, a recruitment program designed to drag Arkansas beyond its hillbilly, corn cob pipe and moonshine image by luring out-of-state businesses into Arkansas through promises of state-backed low-interest loans, nearly free land and buildings, coupled with huge tax incentives. Jobs for Arkansans was the young governor's pledge, and Dickey, at first, thought maybe Clinton's plan was working. Bill Clinton's industry recruitment plan had worked all right. Its purpose was to attract industry. But what it had attracted and recruited was the CIA, and along with it, covert operations which had been banned by the United States Congress. But what was peculiar about the MENA airport was the level of sophistication found in all sorts of aircraft maintenance operations situated alongside MENA's single north-south runway. Not to mention that remote MENA was the home of only 5,000 people. High-tech aircraft overhaul facilities located deep in a densely wooded region of the Ouachita mountain range. Businesses drawing from a labor pool not normally associated with skilled technicians. Well, all of this made Dickey suspicious. So what had Dickey found in that isolated little burg known as MENA, Arkansas? A town with no four-lane highway access. A town where everyone either knew each other or was related. A town that was harboring a deep, dark secret. The aftermath of a large-scale CIA-like operation that was soon to have a very bright light shone upon it. What had triggered Dickey's suspicion was the extensive security barring access to the airport, as well as the presence of a sea of very large airplanes. Airplanes bearing new paint jobs, foreign registrations, and markings from cities situated long distances from tiny MENA. This prompted her to interview a series of individuals who owned or operated aircraft modification and overhaul facilities at the MENA airport. Dickey focused immediately on why the need for such elaborate security, which included the use of employee ID badges. George Reeb, the owner of a shop that had retrofitted CIA aircraft, responded as follows.
Well, you have to tighten up security whenever you're around aircraft because of the safety factor. And I think it's a good idea because, you know, since we're growing so fast, a lot of times you're not familiar with all your employees. And to have badges, you can distinguish who's an employee and who's an employee for another company on the field versus just someone coming in to look around. And you can't quite have that.
When asked why he had relocated to MENA from Maryland, Reeb responded.
Well, I worked for Fokker Aircraft at the time and was handling used aircraft. And one of the customers told me about MENA, Arkansas, to have aircraft refurbished, and I never heard of MENA, Arkansas before.
Dickey inquired about MENA's customer base, and Reeb provided.
Had an airplane last week leave for Australia. 2 weeks prior to that to Australia. We have two more coming that are going to Australia. We send aircraft to Europe, all over the world.
Reeb's response about refurbishing aircraft from as far away as Australia should have alerted Dickey that something was amiss. The operating cost to fly a large airplane from Australia to MENA would far exceed any savings realized by having work performed in rural Arkansas. Dickey was then able to penetrate the security of Rich Mountain Aviation, the CIA's primary facility at MENA, the very one that had been used by Barry Seal's organization. Dickey was able to film both Fred Hampton Jr. and Joseph Neville Evans, Seal's trusted mechanics, both of whom were assets of the CIA and DEA. Dickey then interviewed Fred Hampton, and again, the discussion centered on the need for elaborate security.
Well, the security fence, well, that was something we put up probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. We put it up in anticipation of our first inspection by the military. Being that these are their aircraft, and they are used as part of this missile defense system in Marshall Islands.
This was obviously a cover story. Dickey would later discover that office employees of Rich Mountain had been asked to believe concocted cover stories as well. This went as far as one secretary being told that one of Barry Seal's planes had been modified to haul porpoises. Dickey's suspicions solidified into reality a few months later. Through the Iran-Contra hearings in Washington, a connection had been made between the Contras and the MENA operation. This prompted Dickey to dig back into the history of the government's clandestine involvement with Rich Mountain Aviation, a company that was surfacing as one that had performed strange modifications to CIA aircraft. A central figure was also emerging, a man named Adler Berryman Seal.
This is Barry Seal, a highly publicized drug smuggler originally operating out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Since 1978, he carried out one of the largest drug smuggling operations between the United States and Central America. In the spring of 1982, Louisiana State Police warned Seal that they would tail him wherever he went in efforts to stop his operation. It's believed that Seal decided to move his operation out of that state after the warning. It was here, at Rich Mountain Aviation, that authorities believed Barry Seal moved his operation. Terry Capehart owned a business at the MENA airport, and he remembers when he first met Barry Seal in 1981.
Of course, I didn't know who Barry Seal was. I'd never heard of the man. And Freddie introduced me to him.
Capehart didn't know of Seal's drug background then, but remembers that this man, Joe Evans, former partner of Freddie Hampton's, brought in one of Seal's planes to Rich Mountain Aviation. Evans declined to comment for TV5 News, saying it's his policy to, quote, keep quiet, unquote. Capehart said he began to see more and more of Barry Seal, especially after the spring of 1982. He didn't suspect anything until the Polk County Sheriff called him in with some troubling information.
I came in possession of some information that indicated some aircraft being serviced and stored on the airport here was being used in an illegal international operation.
Capehart then began noticing some alterations to Barry Seal's aircraft that he says are common to drug smugglers.
That I seen myself, Freddie and Dwayne Hill, which was an employee of Rich Mountain Aviation, changed the end number on one of the airplanes so that they were both identical, and then that aircraft made a flight. If they got caught or somebody was on them or turned the end number in, they can just take the tape, yank it off the airplane's set, say, in Florida, Louisiana, wherever. DEA or an agency comes up and asks about it, they'll say, hey, this is not the end number. That airplane's sitting in MENA, Arkansas, inside the hangar.
A former employee of Rich Mountain Aviation also saw unusual modifications and was given far-fetched reasons for them.
What Joe had told me that it was going to be used to transport porpoises on. And the other guy just kind of looked at Joe and said, that's a good one.
Well, former Sheriff Hadaway says he had plenty of evidence to prove a conspiracy, but in 1984, Seal became an informant for the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. It was then that the sheriff was told to halt his investigation into Seal and Rich Mountain Aviation. 2 years later, Seal was murdered by Colombian hitmen for his role as an informant. The grand jury is expected to look into the activities of Barry Seal at MENA Airport prior to 1984. Local investigators believe they have a strong case, but have wondered why it's taken so long to come to court. Tomorrow night, we'll show how the covert smuggling of arms to Contra rebels in Nicaragua may have slowed down one aspect of drug investigations by local authorities.
As Nikki just noted, her investigation was now turning up evidence that MENA had been a staging area for arms shipments to Central America. Isn't it interesting that a freshman journalist like Dickey was already making the MENA connection? As the Iran-Contra hearing in Washington raged on, the teams of seasoned federal investigators should have been following Dickey because she had also made the Fat Lady connection as well. To smuggle arms to Nicaragua from the MENA airport required not only a skilled pilot like Barry Seal, but also a large military transport plane. Dickey had learned that Barry Seal's CIA-provided C-123K military cargo plane had been based at Rich Mountain Aviation, and this caused her to file part two of a series.
This man, the late Barry Seal, was a known drug smuggler, whom authorities believed moved his drug smuggling base of operation from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to MENA, Arkansas in 1982. In 1984, he parked this plane at Rich Mountain Aviation at Mina's airport.
I know that one time Mr. Seals was working in it, and he had some ropes around it. And we were instructed not to go near the plane while Mr. Seals was in there working.
Was informed that this aircraft had been used to smuggle some cocaine into the United States. Then, subsequent to that, some information that it may have been used to, in an operation that was used to embarrass the Nicaraguan government.
With this information, the former sheriff sought a court order to confiscate the plane in June of 1984. Everything was lined up, but then he received a telephone call from a Drug Enforcement Agency supervisor from Miami named Robert Jara.
He finally disclosed to me and asked me not to confiscate the airplane, told me that if I did, that I would just be ordered to give it back to him, that in fact the DEA did have a large financial interest in the aircraft.
At this point, Hadaway's investigation into Barry Seals' drug smuggling activities at Rich Mountain Aviation came to a screeching halt. 6 months later, Seals' plane left Mina. The next time the sheriff heard about it, it had crashed in Nicaragua during a gun-running mission to the Contra rebels. Hadaway's run-in with the DEA would have gone unnoticed, except for an April 1987 broadcast on CBS's West 57th Street, called The CIA Connection, Drugs for Guns.
Do you really believe the government decided to get into the drug business in order to pay for the Contra? The American government.
As incredible as it may sound, I believe that not only decided to get into it, I think orchestrated the whole thing.
I need more than that. Bring it up a bit. Good. There you go.
These two Fort Smith men saw the story and were discussing it in a local bar. An assistant U.S. attorney overheard their conversation and told him his office was working on a case just like that.
He mentioned that their office had a case and that in the process of that, they had contacted some people in Florida for some assistance, and then another agency in Florida had contacted their office and told them to drop the case and get off of it.
Bothers me to think that a competent attorney's office could be restrained from doing its job. That's what bothers me.
These men also say the attorney said the case in question involved Barry Seal activities in the MENA area. The Congressional Subcommittee on Crime has now begun its own investigation into the MENA connection. Tomorrow night, we'll show you how a probe into a money laundering scheme in MENA seems to have gone nowhere.
Drugs, guns, money laundering, cover-up. The CIA's MENA connection appeared to be reaching critical mass. A federal grand jury was preparing to expose the whole seedy affair. Dickie was following a trail she probably thought would lead to a Pulitzer Prize in investigative journalism. Here she was in rural western Arkansas, covering a federal grand jury proceeding that was destined to prove that the CIA had not only violated congressional law by shipping arms to the Contras, but had also allowed their Black Operations aircraft to transport cocaine into the United States.
The issue of a drug smuggling conspiracy revolves around this convicted drug smuggler, the late Barry Seal. Former Seal pilots spoke at a grand jury this week about whether their former boss had moved his operation from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Rich Mountain Aviation in Mena, Arkansas. One pilot who testified told TV5 News Rich Mountain Aviation was simply used by Barry Seal, and Seal didn't involve the company in his drug smuggling activities. But a couple years ago, other witnesses testified at a grand jury about another possible aspect of this conspiracy, money laundering, and nothing happened. Catherine Gann used to work as a secretary for Freddie Hampton of Rich Mountain Aviation. She says she handled lots of cash for her boss, but sometimes in an extraordinary manner.
I was told to deposit the large amounts of cash in amounts of less than $10,000. Even if we had $15,000 or $20,000, I would go to two separate banks and deposit less than $10,000 at one bank and less than $10,000 at another.
What she's talking about is money laundering or structuring deposits to avoid filling out one of these Internal Revenue Service forms called a currency transaction report.
I asked Fred Hampton why he wanted me to deposit it this way, and he said, IRS won't get this. We won't have to pay taxes on it.
Union Bank of Mena is one of the banks that Kathy Gann was told to deposit large amounts of cash. One Union Bank employee told TV5 News that on one occasion, a former bank official divided the cash for Rich Mountain Aviation and personally went to different tellers and had each of them deposit $10,000 into the Rich Mountain Aviation account. Catherine Gann gave testimony to an IRS agent about the illegal practice, but found that when she appeared before a grand jury, it asked no questions about the money laundering.
When I left there, I was wondering, as I walked down the hall, I wondered, well, why did they bring me up here?
In the meantime, the fact that she gave testimony has caused her to live in fear.
I kept waiting and waiting to hear from somebody, and I was scared all this time. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And, you know, I knew that his truck had been outside my house. I was scared for my girls.
People close to this issue wonder why such a cut-and-dried case failed to produce indictments. The former Polk County Sheriff has lost faith in the process of justice.
They do not have a great deal of confidence in the function of the federal criminal justice system at this time.
But even if this grand jury fails to produce any indictments, other law enforcement officials say they will continue their separate investigations. In MENA, I'm Teresa Dickey reporting for the News People.
You're probably wondering, how many indictments did the Fort Smith grand jury hand up? Answer, none. But Dickey noted that several other law enforcement officials were committed to continuing their investigations into the MENA connection if the grand jury bore no fruit. And investigate they did. In fact, their efforts triggered the interest of out-of-state media.
MENA is a town of patriots and pickups, a town of 5,000 in the mountains of western Arkansas, a place that would seem as far away from American foreign policy as a place could get. And yet, one little airport on the southern edge of town is managing to raise questions that extend far beyond the city limits.
1,000 miles away from MENA, here in Washington, there are investigators for both the House and the Senate who would like to know what's going on at that little airport in western Arkansas.
As Oliver North's public battle over government secrets and the illegal supply of weapons to the Nicaraguan Contras is waged in Washington, congressional investigators in recent months have tried to learn if MENA, Arkansas was an illegal staging area for shipping guns to the U.S.-backed Contra rebels. This is a strange story. The facts already known are bizarre enough. What Unit 5 has been able to learn makes this story stranger still. It all begins in 1982, when this man, Adler Berryman Seal, showed up in MENA, Arkansas.
My top load paid me $1.5 million for a single trip.
Berry Seal was a drug smuggler, an extraordinary multi-million-dollar-a-year drug smuggler, who with the help of several associates kept and serviced his drug planes in a hangar at the MENA airport. Those planes, according to investigators, were illegally modified with extra fuel tanks and instruments in order to fly long-distance drug missions to Central and South America. Barry Seal paid his associates for those modifications with tens of thousands of dollars in cash, money which, according to investigators, was illegally laundered by Seal's associates at banks in MENA.
Yeah, I'm pleading guilty.
But when Barry Seal was finally caught in 1984, investigators for the FBI, the IRS, and other agencies of law enforcement were told little or nothing about a special deal he had made with the Federal Drug Task Force headed by then-Vice President George Bush. The deal? The government kept Barry Seal out of jail, and in exchange, Seal became a drug informant and helped put in jail some of his own associates in the international drug trade. But that wasn't all that Barry Seal did. Russell Welch, criminal investigator for the Arkansas State Police.
Did Barry Seal ever say to you, I work for the CIA?
He said he was working. I'd worked for the CIA.
Unit 5 has learned in the early 1980s, even before his arrest, Seal had bought one of his planes from a CIA front, Air America. The plane was used by Seal for drug smuggling, and the CIA company was paid in the traditional drug dealer fashion of $300,000 in cash. According to this confidential FBI teletype obtained by Unit 5, one of Seal's associates said he was maintaining Seal's aircraft at the MENA airport for the CIA. So what was Barry Seal actually doing?
One federal agent under very strict confidence told me that it was assumed within his agency Barry Seal was carrying guns to Central America in exchange was bringing drugs back on a free ride.
Russell Welch of the Arkansas State Police was one of dozens of investigators who for years had been tracking Barry Seal and his associates. As these documents obtained by Unit 5 indicate, the FBI, the IRS,
Customs and the Attorney General of Louisiana formed just a partial list of those who wanted some answers. They didn't get them. Internal FBI documents indicate investigators were told not to look into any of Seale's activities that occurred before his 1984 plea agreement. So, blocked from seeking indictments against Seale, investigators sought indictments against Seale's associates at the MENA airport for allegedly aiding in the drug smuggling and for alleged IRS violations. So far, no indictments have been produced. At the end of this year, the statute of limitations will run out on those alleged crimes. As for Barry Seale, time ran out in 1986 when he was assassinated in Louisiana by Colombian drug dealers. Some of Seale's secrets died with him. But some of those secrets today remain guarded by the National Security Council, the agency for which Oliver North worked. The NSC has blocked a recent congressional request to examine the relationship of drug smuggling to American foreign policy in Central America.
As a citizen, America didn't get a stay in court.
Chicago journalist Carol Moran unearthed a whole new facet of the MENA operation. As her investigation continued, she connected the dots from MENA to Washington and discovered that a major portion of Oliver North's Contra assistance program took place in a wooded, mountainous region north of the MENA airport. Watch part two of Marin's special.
Angola, where the United States has supported rebels against the Marxist government. South Africa, where the United States has walked a tightrope between the minority white government and the majority black population. Central America, where the United States has tried to overthrow the leftist government of Nicaragua and prop up the centrist government of El Salvador. Three critical areas for U.S. foreign policy that seem very distant from the concerns of a small community in western Arkansas, but maybe not. MENA, Arkansas is a small town in the mountains along the Arkansas-Oklahoma border. It has no interstate highway. It takes some effort to get here. But some people, some very interesting people in recent years, apparently made that effort.
I don't think that there's really anything that we can pin down about them.
I believe there's truth in every story.
The rumors and gossip surround two small airfields. The first is the MENA airport, where this giant C-130 military cargo plane, tail number N4469P, arrived one day last year. It is a huge plane for a small airport, a plane that originally belonged to the Royal Australian Air Force. Curiously, around the same time, a group of Australians arrived to work at the airport, telling investigators like Russell Welch of the Arkansas State Police some strange things.
You've spoken with some of the Australians at the airport, correct?
Yes.
And some of them have told you they're part of a CIA operation?
Yes, it didn't seem to be too much of a secret.
An Australian at that time told Welch the C-130 would soon be on its way to Angola, mission undisclosed. Unit 5 has learned of two current federal probes at the airport. U.S. Customs in Houston is investigating possible violations of the Neutrality Act, whether or not this plane, considered to be a weapon of war, might be on its way into the hands of South Africa. The second investigation by Arkansas Congressman Bill Alexander probes, among other things, whether or not the CIA, within the past year and a half, contracted with various partners to transport arms to Central America, allowing them to bring drugs back to MENA, with distribution in Miami or New York. The mayor of MENA, Jerry Montgomery, doesn't believe any of it.
That's hard for me to believe, that MENA, Arkansas, was used.
But there's more. Down a winding dirt road, back in the mountains, where even the locals can get lost, resides yet another mystery. Now, this landing strip is a curious thing. It exists in an isolated mountain valley in the middle of nowhere, when there already is an airport just 11 miles from here. So why was 2,700 feet of runway installed here? Why was this landing strip built? And what was it built for? One person who thinks he knows the answer is Gene Wheaton, a former criminal investigator for the U.S. Army who has done his own investigation.
They were training pilots to make night flights and takeoffs and landings of strips that had no lighting, no air control, so forth.
Wheaton's deposition came last year in an unsuccessful civil lawsuit against Oliver North and other principals in the Iran-Contra scandal. Oliver North won that battle and now in Washington fights the criminal charges against him. It is a fight over what government secrets should stay secret. In some ways, on a smaller scale, that's the same battle going on in MENA, Arkansas. where investigators from a variety of agencies for a number of years have asked questions of the government and have received few answers. The people of MENA themselves continue to debate whether or not their small town has some ongoing role in American foreign policy.
I don't see how it could have been kept a secret.
There are definitely fishy things going on, and there's a lot of cover-up.
So, in the mid to late 1980s, news of the MENA connection spilled forth. This may lead one to wonder if the media simply dropped the MENA story after the aftermath of the Iran-Contra scandal died down. Quite the opposite. Time and time again, the story would leap into the headlines of predominantly Arkansas newspapers. Arkansas journalists, law enforcement officials, and citizens groups would try in vain to advance the investigations, but an invisible force seemed to be keeping the lid on Arkansas's Pandora's box. Then, in 1992, during the presidential campaign, after the name of Bill Clinton was thrust into the mainstream media, a renewed interest in MENA surfaced as throngs of journalists rushed to Little Rock to investigate the obscure young governor who was seeking the Democratic Party's nomination. Countless reporters dug, probed, and pried into the layers of lies, deceit, and distortions that by then effectively interred MENA's dark secrets. Russell Welch of the Arkansas State Police and Bill Duncan, by then an investigator with the Arkansas Attorney General's office, were interviewed time and time again as the media slowly began to understand that a large-scale, high-profile CIA operation had in fact taken place on Arkansas soil on Bill Clinton's watch as governor. Arkansas Democratic Congressman Bill Alexander renewed his efforts to get the truth out. The truth that even he had been stonewalled as his office attempted to dissect the MENA story. Then, in April of 1992, as the pressure cooker containing the MENA scandal seemed ready to burst, with the resulting steam most assuredly scalding Bill Clinton and destroying his political career, Time magazine came to the rescue. Time's full-page story, which savagely attacked the credibility of Terry Reid and ridiculed nearly everyone associated with the MENA investigation, effectively nailed the lid once again on the CIA's box of dirty secrets. What the Time article failed to tell the reader, however, was Time's investigative journalist Richard Behar, who wrote the story Anatomy of a Smear, was actually in Arkansas helping to undermine the investigative efforts of other credible journalists. Behar had discovered that the news magazine The Nation was actually corroborating portions of Terry Reid's story concerning weapons parts manufacturing. Through a libel suit in federal court launched by Terry Reid against Time magazine, the following tape-recorded conversation was obtained. In it, Behar is conversing with Bill Clinton's friend Webster Hubbell, who was then working with Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock. In the tape, Behar is alerting Hubbell of an active media investigation into Hubbell's father-in-law's manufacturing company, POM, in Russellville, Arkansas. Behar is warning Hubbell that his brother-in-law, Skeeter Ward, is divulging classified information to the magazine The Nation. Remember, according to CIA insider Terry Reid, it was POM, on the surface a manufacturer of parking meters, who was building weapons parts for the CIA through an agreement with Ivers Johnson Firearms, a CIA proprietary company situated in Jacksonville, Arkansas.
Well, listen, can I make a recommendation to you off the record?
Sure.
And this is, I don't particularly want these guys to know that I'm on this story. Uh-huh. But it seems to me they're acting a little irresponsibly. The Nation newspaper?
Uh-huh.
Apparently, I heard through the grapevine, they had an interview with Skeeter.
Uh-huh. And shouldn't be talking to them.
And supposedly, Skeeter told them that you guys have done exit cones on nuclear weapons at POM.
He wouldn't have said that. He knows better.
Well, that's just the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know why it would come back to me to different channels that have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Unless the story's taking a life of its own.
Yeah.
What you may want to do is give a ring to The Nation.
Yeah.
And speak to whoever's doing the story and clear it up before they put it in their damn newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you didn't hear it from me.
I appreciate it. I really do.
So why did Time Magazine use its vast resources to protect Bill Clinton? Maybe the fact that Bill Clinton's friend and former Oxford roommate, Strobe Talbot, who was then Time's editor-at-large, played a role. Did Mr. Talbot receive a reward for short-circuiting the investigation? The perception is certainly there. Mr. Talbot joined the Clinton administration in 1993 and is now the number two man in the Department of State. Is it possible that an organization that's perceived as credible as Time Magazine is in effect under the control of the CIA? A CIA investigator supplying sworn testimony for the Reed versus Time libel suit after being asked to evaluate Time's article on MENA said in an affidavit he believed the article was an obvious disinformation tool. So, with Time Magazine's help, it appeared that MENA would die and the truth would never come out. But the government had underestimated the determination of Terry Reed. Terry and his wife, Janice, were seeking complete vindication in federal court in Little Rock as a result of being the victims of a manufactured crime. Although silent and gagged within the federal court system for nearly 2.5 years, the Reeds emerged victorious. Terry was acquitted of all charges by a federal judge in Wichita, Kansas, charges involving the theft of an airplane, and Janice's case was eventually dropped. But they both wanted to see those who had needlessly ensnared them in the manufactured crime brought to justice. The Reeds and their attorneys saw this blatant misuse of the criminal justice system being used solely as a way to destroy their credibility, thus insulating important politicians from MENA scandal. The Reeds had filed a civil rights lawsuit in July 1991 against Bill Clinton's chief of security, Arkansas State Police Captain Raymond Buddy Young. It was quite obvious from the court record that Young, working in concert with others, had helped to orchestrate the wrongful criminal indictment brought against them. Terry knew that properly trying the civil rights case would require reopening the entire MENA story. Power brokers of both political parties were desperate to ensure this didn't happen. As the Reed case simmered in a court file in Little Rock, the media was beginning to probe into the financial dealings of Bill and Hillary Clinton and their friends. By early 1994, a new term, Whitewater, would consume the headlines and refocus the media's attention to Arkansas. And this time, reporters would attempt to better explain Bill Clinton's meteoric rise to power. Once again, that four-letter word, M-E-N-A, would resurface. This time, the media would be armed with the information detailed in Terry Reed's book, Compromised. The reporters were beginning to notice a shocking similarity between the players of the MENA story and those of the Whitewater scandal. The connection Reed had made between people involved with the CIA's enterprise and some very prominent Arkansans caused CBS News to do an 8-minute story on the scandal that just won't go away.
A civil war in Central America, drug smuggling in Arkansas, President Ronald Reagan and President Bill Clinton, the subject of tonight's Eye on America. But first, a little background. In the early 80s, a war was underway for control of Nicaragua. On one side, the ruling Marxist regime, the Sandinistas. On the other side, rebel forces, the Contras, labeled by the Reagan administration as pro-democracy freedom fighters. A base of support for the Contra movement, remote western Arkansas. Correspondent Bill Plant has been investigating for tonight's Eye on America.
1983, Ronald Reagan was president, Bill Clinton was governor, and little MENA, Arkansas, changed from a quiet town to a center for drug smuggling and reported Contra support activity. In the middle of it all, this man, admitted dope smuggler Barry Seal.
He started doing business with the Ochoa family in Colombia, hauling his dope.
Arkansas State Trooper Russell Witch investigated Seal's organization.
Each trip would have 250 to 350 pounds of cocaine. He stated that he made $1 million in one trip alone.
Seal built this hangar at Rich Mountain Aviation at the MENA airport for his high-tech smuggling planes, used to fly guns to the Contras and more than 20 tons of cocaine into the U.S. over 3.5 years. Former IRS agent William Duncan traced some of Seale's drug profits laundered through MENA banks.
We had direct testimony from people who were involved in the money laundering operation. We had testimony from people at banks who observed the transactions.
And Barry Seale had another agenda. Pilot Terry Reed claims Seale hired him in 1983 to train Contra pilots at this remote airstrip north of MENA.
I was involved in the flight training aspects of upgrading Nicaraguan freedom fighters to make them capable of flying combat aircraft.
The airstrip was built by Seale's organization and also reportedly used to train Contra ground troops. In 1984, Seale was arrested for smuggling and was turned by the Drug Enforcement Administration into an informant and smuggler for the government. With help from both Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and the CIA, Seale pulled off a spectacular drug sting. His own C-123 to Nicaragua, where he took these pictures of Sandinistas helping load Colombian cocaine onto his plane. After the sting, Seale flew the C-123 to the MENA airport, where it sat for a year. It was later shot down over Nicaragua, filled with guns for the Contras. By late 1985, Agent Duncan had gathered substantial evidence, alleged money laundering, against Seale's associates Fred Hampton and Joe Evans of Rich Mountain Aviation.
What happened when you tried to make this case before a grand jury?
I was never asked to present the evidence to a grand jury, ever.
The evidence was in this 24-count draft indictment prepared for the federal grand jury in January of 1986, but the grand jury never saw it.
The United States Department of Justice did not pursue the cases, did not present the evidence of money laundering to the grand jury.
Former U.S. Attorney Mike Fitzhugh, who handled the MENA cases, says that was because Agent Duncan asked for a delay.
I consented to his request that the matter not be presented at the grand jury session meeting in January of 86.
Agent Duncan says he made no such request.
That is absolutely false.
An FBI internal memo from early February 1986, obtained by CBS News, says Fitzhugh was withholding presentation of the indictment, but there is no mention of a request from IRS agent Duncan for a delay.
I would have been the last person in the world to have tried to delay evidence going to the grand jury.
We asked Attorney Fitzhugh if he was told to delay the indictment by the Reagan Justice Department.
There was not any type of pressure or influence put on me or anyone in my office that I'm aware of.
For two more years, Trooper Welch watched as Fitzhugh's federal grand jury failed to return indictments in the MENA cases.
It was a slow realization over a period of time that this isn't like any other case. It's not going anywhere. We're wasting our time.
By 1988, Trooper Welch and Agent Duncan had given up on the Reagan Justice Department, but not on their investigation. They had hopes that the state of Arkansas could impanel a grand jury to hear evidence of money laundering, drug smuggling, and conspiracy. They went directly to then-Governor Bill Clinton. That part of the story in a moment. Back now with more of our Eye on America investigation of drugs, guns, and money laundering in Arkansas in the 1980s. By 1988, law enforcement officials investigating the case had given up on the federal government, pinning their hopes for prosecution on the state judicial system. Correspondent Bill Plant picks up the story from there.
By 1988, almost everyone in Arkansas had heard about MENA.
It was here, at Rich Mountain Aviation, that authorities believed Barry Seale moved his operation.
There were news reports about smuggling and Contra support activity around the MENA airport. Congress had begun an inquiry, and the media covered it all. At the Polk County Courthouse in MENA, Trooper Welch and Agent Duncan turned to County Prosecutor Charles Black for help.
When it became apparent that nothing was going to be done on the federal level, that's when I began more actively pursuing it.
Prosecutor Black, a Clinton supporter, met with the governor and handed him a letter requesting money for a state grand jury on MENA.
His response to me was that he would get a man, something to the effect that he would get a man on it and would get word back to me. And I never heard back.
Years later, Clinton said he offered $25,000 to Prosecutor Black's boss to fund a grand jury. But Charles Black and his boss claim they never heard about any offer of money from Governor Clinton.
I believe Bill Clinton's an honest, respectable man, and I have to believe that he did that. But the fact is, I never got that word myself.
But the MENA issue would not die.
I don't think that the story of Iran-Contra has yet been fully told.
In 1988, Arkansas Congressman Bill Alexander asked the General Accounting Office to investigate connections between the MENA airport, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's Contra operations, and Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. Alexander says the National Security Council, in this letter, refused to cooperate, challenging GAO's authority and effectively killing the investigation. Then MENA became an issue in the 1990 Attorney General's race in Arkansas between Republican Asa Hutchinson and Democrat Winston Bryant. Sources tell CBS News that Governor Clinton's aide, Betsy Wright, asked Bryant to stay away from the MENA issue. Wright denies it. In 1991, Congressman Alexander got the Arkansas State Police a federal grant to reopen the MENA investigation. Sources tell CBS News that Governor Clinton's staff was involved in the discussions about what to do with that grant. The money went to State Police Chief Tommy Goodwin.
That money was discussed around here for quite a while, and we finally said, we'll just turn it back. We don't have anything to spend it on.
Well, what happened to the state case?
Nothing happened to the state case. A grand jury was never called. It just died.
I maintained a certain amount of faith that at some point the problem would be solved. That never occurred.
Has not occurred.
Has not occurred to this date.
Barry Seal's organization helped the Contras, smuggled tons of cocaine, and laundered drug profits through Arkansas. Why did the Reagan Justice Department fail to prosecute? Did Bill Clinton, then the governor, failed to provide leadership and support for a successful state prosecution? The White House says he did all he could. But Agent Duncan, Trooper Welch, Prosecutor Black, and a lot of other people are still looking for answers. In Washington, this is Bill Plant for Eye on America.
Why the Arkansas grand jury was not successful in bringing forth indictments, and why the media was unsuccessful in detailing the inner workings of the CIA's operations, requires the insight and comments of Terry Reed.
Hello there, I'm Terry Reed. Let me tell you a little about myself. I'm a family man, businessman, and Vietnam veteran whose life got a little off course as the result of the so-called Iran-Contra affair. But just to set the record straight, I'm not a drug trafficker, and I've never knowingly associated with anyone who is. I was, however, recruited and freely enlisted in the so-called Enterprise for the purpose of assisting the Contras. I did so purely for patriotic reasons, although others I worked with obviously had selfish agendas. Be that as it may, I have no regrets in helping to rid Nicaragua of the communist-backed Sandinista regime. I would do it all again. I'm participating in the production of this documentary to show you that the real Nicaraguan guerrilla support effort took place in Arkansas through a very sophisticated CIA network set in place by the Reagan White House and monitored by Bill Clinton's gubernatorial administration. I know this because I was part of that support effort. In fact, after viewing this documentary, I'm confident you will conclude that through the efforts of Ronald Reagan's Attorney General Edwin Meese, phase one of the deceit began. Let me explain. By Meese divulging the unauthorized weapons shipments to our enemy Iran, and accusing a lowly Marine Lieutenant Colonel of seizing the reins of foreign policy. Well, that act in itself was a clever diversion. The media went for the bait and immediately labeled the entire fiasco the Iran-Contra affair. But instead of scurrying east out of Washington and focusing their investigative efforts on the Middle East, the hostage crisis, and the diversion of weapons sales profits to the Contras, reporters should have gone west to Arkansas. But why should you believe me? Let me tell you a little about my life within the intelligence community and how a starry-eyed and patriotic young man from Missouri got swept into a world of espionage, secret foreign policy, deniable operations, and deceit. To begin with, Harry S. Truman was and still is my personal hero. I had the very good fortune of meeting Mr. Truman when I was 17 years old, and that occasion left a lasting imprint in my mind. You know, Missouri politics, religion, duty, honor, and commitment to family and community greatly influenced my upbringing. As the eldest of six children, I can most assuredly say that my father, himself a veteran of World War II, raised me and my three brothers with a clear understanding that we owed a debt to our country, that we had to repay our nation for the privilege of living in freedom. And being raised in Carthage, Missouri, a town of 10,000, a true Norman Rockwell setting, only 21 miles from the birthplace of President Truman, instilled in me a set of rural Midwestern values that I cherish and protect to this day. When my country called during the Vietnam War, I responded. I felt it was time to apply the military skills taught me from 4 years of Army ROTC training. After all, it was Harry Truman who had commissioned the ROTC program in Carthage that I had been fortunate enough to serve as a cadet company commander. After taking the military oath at the induction center in Kansas City, Missouri, our government placed me in Air Force Intelligence. Upon graduation from a whole series of intelligence curriculums, I was then handpicked to serve in Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara's ultra-top secret unit designated Task Force Alpha, based in the remote northeast jungles of Thailand. From there, the U.S. Air Force orchestrated a secret air and ground war in Laos and Cambodia. Our mission was to be the deniable link between authorized military operations and the unauthorized activities of the Central Intelligence Agency. We assigned Air America the tasks that were just quite frankly too unthinkable for the U.S. military to conduct. Now, this was my introduction to black or deniable activities. In the course of serving 8 years within the Air Force's intelligence community and pulling 2.5 years of duty in Southeast Asia, I met and worked with some of the people who would later surface in the so-called Iran-Contra affair. In fact, it was in Southeast Asia that I met and worked with a man named William Cooper, the Air America pilot who died in the crash of an American cargo plane that was shot down in Nicaragua October 5th of 1986, the crash that exposed the CIA's efforts to violate the so-called Bolin Amendments, you know, the laws Congress passed to limit American assistance to the Contras. But after becoming disillusioned with the peacetime military, I elected to be separated from the military in 1976. I then enrolled in a pilot training curriculum in Southwest Missouri and graduated 3 years later with nearly every available aviation license and rating known. Then, by sheer coincidence, I entered an industry laden with agents of the KGB and those of our so-called ally Japan, who were actually attempting to steal American defense technology. So it was in Oklahoma City in 1980, while working as executive vice president of a high technology trading company, that I was recruited by the FBI's counterintelligence division to monitor and help disrupt the efforts of agents of the Kremlin who had penetrated the American machine tool industry. These activities and adventures, I might add, required me to travel behind the Iron Curtain, not only to sow some seeds of deceit, but to pirate some Soviet technology as well. Where I feel this story gets interesting is later, while working under deep cover on the now famous Toshiba case, the one involving the theft and sale of American nuclear submarine technology to the KGB by Japan's Toshiba Machine Tool Company. It was then that I was put into play with an agent of the CIA who carried the codename of John Cathy. Now, this took place in Oklahoma City in early 1982. And Agent John Cathy's real name is Oliver Lawrence North, the same Marine Lieutenant Colonel later accused of taking over the Department of State by Ronald Reagan's administration. As North and I worked together, we shared memories of not only our combat experiences in Southeast Asia, but rehashed our mutual disdain for Congress as well, the same Congress that had put us as young soldiers in harm's way and then sat back and debated the morality of it all. The North also shared with me what he referred to as a secret Reagan plan to destroy the USSR. He continuously referred to Russia in our conversations as a failed colonial power, that the timing was right to incite revolution within the Russian colonies. It was through these efforts, North confided, that the CIA felt Russia collapse economically. Then North asked if I was interested in helping to deal what he called a death blow to the evil empire that it kept its finger on the nuclear trigger throughout my lifetime. I can say this, I enthusiastically jumped on board what is now referred to as the secret Reagan agenda. It was then, through my rather intimate relationship with North, that I was quietly tapped to support the Contra effort. North arranged for me to be introduced to a man named Adler Behrman Seale. Barry Seale was an asset of the CIA, and the man tasked with setting up the necessary facilities to keep the Contras alive in body and soul, as Ronald Reagan had instructed Oliver North. Now, that brings this story to Mena, Arkansas. because it was in Mena that Barry Seal had set up operations to covertly support and modify aircraft belonging to various federal agencies. Hey, but enough about my background. Besides, I'm getting bored just sitting here talking. You know, Barry Seal referred to me, as he did to himself, as a calculated risk taker. And I suppose that sums up the nature of most pilots. I've also been accused of being a rather action-oriented individual, so I've got an idea. Let's leave this stuffy office and head on out to the airport. You know, airplanes play a major role in this story. In fact, airplanes leave the so-called trail of truth that will follow as we lay open the MENA connection for public inspection. As you can see, I'm now dressed more appropriate to that the role of a flight instructor. This is the way I dressed as I trained the Nicaraguan pilots in near MENA, Arkansas. We're also filming now in the Mall aircraft factory in Georgia for a reason. That reason being the Mall aircraft such as this one, came to bear heavy in the Iran-Contra story. As Richard Secord, Oliver North, and the CIA went shopping for small aircraft to use in Nicaragua in a hostile, very hostile combat environment, they came to the Mall Aircraft Company because Mall had a proven track record and built a very unique aircraft, an aircraft very suited to be used in rough terrain, unimproved conditions, primarily because of the what is referred to as a conventional landing gear configuration using a tail wheel in lieu of a nose wheel. The Mall aircraft, in addition to being a high-performance STOL, or short takeoff and landing airplane, afforded the capability of delivering the necessary supplies and munitions to the guerrilla war action in Nicaragua as the Contras fought the Sandinista soldiers. My role in all of this, of course, was to use my flight instructor credentials and expertise, pass along my aviation skills to approximately 24 Nicaraguan nationals so that they could, in fact, liberate their own country, so that they could go back and replace the CIA's efforts to keep the Contras alive, body and soul, as Ronald Reagan said, to keep the Contras in the field, supplied with munitions, regardless of what Congress, the American Congress, said. I'm not here to debate the rightness or wrongness of our efforts. In this documentary, I simply want to convince you, the viewer, that this went on and that this aircraft had a very instrumental role in all of that. In my book, Compromised, Clinton, Bush, and the CIA, I refer to a time in 1984 in which a friend of mine, William Cooper, a pilot that I'd known from Thailand, an Air America pilot, flew an aircraft very similar to this aircraft into the North Little Rock Airport. He was flying that day with another Arkansan pilot, a man named Buzz Sawyer. Buzz Sawyer was from Magnolia, Arkansas, and Buzz had a distinguished career in aviation. His roots also went back to that of Air America, Thailand, the CIA, the place where a lot of us young, patriotic people from the Midwest cut our teeth in these deep, dark secrets that are still secrets, for the most part, of what actually went on in Southeast Asia. Little did I know that was the last time I would see Buzz Sawyer. In fact, it was Bill Cooper at the controls of the C-123K, the Fat Lady, that was shot down in Nicaragua October 5th, 1986, thus exposing the whole Iran-Contra affair. In the right seat in that C-123K was Mr. Sawyer as well. I lost two friends that day. I tell you this story now because I think it's important for the American people to understand what we did in and around MENA, Arkansas, and why I chose to cross that line and get involved in a very deep black operation in and around MENA, an operation that neither the Democratic Party nor the Republicans want to accept ever happened.
So the Democrats and Republicans don't want to accept the MENA operation ever happened, huh? That's the problem. A lot of important people who have a lot to lose would like to convince you that MENA never happened. But it did happen. and one very large, undeniable piece of evidence Mina was CIA-backed is the airplane the government provided Barry Seal so he could fly tons of munitions from Arkansas to Central America. That airplane, the Fairchild C-123, nicknamed the Fat Lady, connects dots between the CIA's Air America and Southeast Asia. Mina, Arkansas, the CIA's proprietary airline in Miami, Florida, named Southern Air Transport, and the Iran-Contra affair, the so-called Hasafa shootdown. That was the day Barry Seal's Fat Lady crashed in Nicaragua, and the Reagan-Bush administration could no longer deny they were bypassing the law of Congress and the will of the American people. Let's go back to the airport. Terry would like to show you an airplane similar to an old friend of his. He called her the Fat Lady, and it's time for her to sing. And what a story she has to tell. The real story of Iran-Contra. The one more appropriately entitled, The Mina Connection.
Barry Seal was provided a provider, very appropriately, a C-123K that had been stored in an Air Force museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. That aircraft, the C-123K that Barry Seal affectionately nicknamed the Fat Lady, becomes the common thread that sews together several black operations in a fairly dark period of American history in the mid-1980s. You see, I was at Mena, Arkansas, the day Barry Seal first flew in his C-123K, the Fat Lady. The C-123K was a very instrumental aircraft in that it had the payload capability to fly munitions from Arkansas to staging areas in Central America, primarily Honduras and El Salvador. The interesting part of the story is these were weapons that were drawn from National Guard armories in Arkansas at a time in which Bill Clinton was commander-in-chief of the Arkansas National Guard. Some of these weapons were then mated with secret component parts that were being built by CIA contractors in Arkansas, component parts that would, in effect, bear no serial numbers, component parts that would become untraceable. Little did we all know that a C-123K, such as this one, would be shot down by a Soviet SA-7 handheld missile on October the 5th, 1986, and thereby shed a lot of unwanted light on a very secret operation. A secret operation backed by the CIA to bypass the will of Congress and supply the Contras in their effort to defeat the Sandinista regime.
As you can probably tell, Terry Reed loves airplanes, and flying is one of his passions. His ability to transfer his flying skills to others is why Barry Seal and the CIA hired him. But Terry's story is much larger than just that of a flight instructor. He joined Oliver North's MENA operation with bona fide intelligence credentials provided by the United States Air Force. For this reason, Terry was entrusted to orbit with some pretty heavy hitters coming from both sides of the equation, both government and civilian. Let's catch up with Terry and see if he will tell us the names of some of these heavy hitters in the MENA story. Terry, in your book, Compromised, you talk about being sponsored into Bill Clinton's inner circle shortly after moving to Little Rock in 1983.
That's right. You know, my background's manufacturing. And I'd moved to Arkansas and co-founded a business, an ultralight manufacturing firm, with a man named Seth Ward. Now, Seth refers to himself as a Little Rock industrialist. He is, in fact, a self-made multimillionaire. And Seth is now emerging, though, as sort of the mystery man behind the whole Whitewater affair. Seth has a son-in-law named Webb Hubble. Webb Hubble, of course, worked at the Rose Law Firm and, in fact, right adjacent to Hillary Clinton's office. So, in fact, it was through Seth Ward and Webb Hubble that my wife Janice and I were introduced into the social circles of Little Rock, Arkansas.
Now, is that the same Seth Ward whose name has been associated with Madison Guaranty, the Little Rock Savings and Loan controlled at one time by James McDougal, the so-called friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton who brought them into the Whitewater Land Development Project?
Yeah, that is the same Seth Ward, all right. And, of course, his son-in-law, Webb Hubble, is the man who worked side-by-side with Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm and the man who Clinton had as his number three person in the Department of Justice until Webb resigned. The same Webb Hubble who is now a felon as a result of pleading guilty to Whitewater-related crimes. I believe they included overbilling the government when Webb was at the Rose Law Firm and tax invasion. It looks like Webb Hubble will soon be a star prosecution witness in the Whitewater investigation.
Terry, it seems the Ward family was right in the thick of things. Were there any other family members that play into the story?
Yeah, the Ward family is actually sort of infamous in Arkansas. Seth has one son. His name is Seth Jr. People call him Skeeter. Skeeter manages the family-owned business POM, or Park on Meter, in Russellville, Arkansas. And, of course, the world now knows that POM has a military division that has provided weapons parts for various concerns, including Ivers Johnson Firearms, the CIA's proprietary. You know, Skeeter even admitted this clandestine relationship in a secretly taped interview.
I ran my machines second shift to get the parts out for them real quick, and they never stiffed me, they never paid, they were bankrupt.
But you did make some parts for Ivers Johnson?
I made some firing pins, I think it was, on a screw machine. For them, it's about $12,000 worth, and they never paid, they filed bankruptcy.
But an often overlooked ex-member of the Ward clan is Finus Shelnut. Finus surfaced briefly when the Jennifer Flowers scandal broke. It seems he and Bill Clinton were sharing Jennifer's favors. But when I met Finus in 1983, he was married to Seth Ward's youngest daughter, and it was Finus who worked for a bond trader named Dan Lassiter.
Dan Lassiter? That's a name I've heard before. Isn't he Bill Clinton's old friend, and wasn't he convicted of cocaine charges?
Yeah, that's right. Dan Lassiter is another multimillionaire that enters into this story. Dan, of course, was a very high-profile bond trader who lived in Little Rock in the mid-1980s, traveled in very high social circles. In fact, it was Dan Lassiter who not only employed Finus Shelnut, but it was Dan Lassiter who employed Roger Clinton as well.
Dan Lassiter employed Roger Clinton, the president's brother? Didn't they both go to prison on cocaine charges?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was Roger who was Dan's chauffeur, actually. And, of course, it was Dan Lassiter and Roger who got involved in the whole drug investigation that ultimately ended up ensnaring about 10 other prominent Arkansans, including an Arkansas state senator. So there was a multitude of people that went to prison over this story. Another interesting point, though, that I point out in my book, Lassiter and Company, Dan Lassiter's firm, is where Barry Seal was doing not only his, but the CIA's investment banking.
You're saying, as an insider, that you have knowledge of Barry Seal running the CIA's money through Lassiter and into the Arkansas bond business.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, in fact, Barry Seal confided to me that he was taking millions of dollars of money to Dan Lassiter to more or less be laundered through his firm in the form of loans, money being slipped back quietly to CIA subcontractors, companies performing services for the CIA in Arkansas during this whole time frame.
That sounds like a pretty slick arrangement, but it must have included people beyond Seal and Lassiter to pull that off without triggering questions from bank officials. Can you name any of the recipients of these fictitious loans?
Yes, I can. In my book, in fact, I document a $2.75 million loan made to POM, or Park on Meter. Now, that money was diverted through ADFA, Arkansas Development and Finance Authority, which in itself was a quasi-state-run organization set up by Bill Clinton for the purpose of administering loans to underprivileged companies.
Terry, are you saying that ADFA, the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, a state agency, was created by Bill Clinton as a way to launder CIA money?
I can say this. From its inception in 1985 to 1991, ADFA loaned out over $719 million. Now, there have been Freedom of Information lawsuits filed in Arkansas trying to get the state to show the buyers of those bonds, the bond sales that went to create that kind of money. To date, there's been no admission by the state of where that money came from. And the POM loan, going back to it, was in violation of ADFA's charter, because certainly POM would have qualified for outside loans without ADFA's backing.
That is a lot of money. Nearly $750 million. And you say Barry Seal's organization was responsible for bringing in a substantial amount of that cash.
Well, by Seal's own estimate, he was flying in nearly $40 million a month into Little Rock at the height of the money laundering activities in 1985.
Tell me, has anyone else surfaced who could help corroborate the strange goings-on within the bond industry of Arkansas?
Yes, there's a man named Dennis Patrick and others who have surfaced. But Patrick can document over $109 million was laundered through his bond trading account in the mid-1980s.
Where was Patrick doing his trading?
At Dan Lassiter's. At the same time frame, Barry Seal was flying in the agency's money.
$109 million. No wonder they call Arkansas the land of opportunity. But tell me, when was the MENA operation, as you knew it, when was it curtailed, and why did the CIA shut it down?
Since you brought up their old state slogan, to answer that, you really must go back to their other state slogan, which is Arkansas is a natural high. You see, it was the drug investigation into Dan Lassiter and Roger Clinton that caused the CIA to abruptly curtail their operation and pull out. What had transpired was by 1986, there were two independent grand juries being formed to really start probing into all this money laundering activity, which appeared to be coming from a major drug operation. The last thing the CIA needed was for a multitude of their assets to be dragged before federal grand juries.
Terry, I recall in your book you talking of a high-level secret meeting taking place near Little Rock in early 1986. It included discussions of neutralizing the Justice Department's probe into MENA and Dan Lassiter's firm. Tell us about that meeting. Who attended, and why was the meeting called?
The meeting you're referring to is the meeting I call the bunker meeting, since the meeting took place in a World War II ammunition storage bunker at Camp Robinson, an army camp slightly northwest of Little Rock. The meeting had been called, actually, as an operational transitional meeting to discuss the nuts and bolts of moving part of this operation to Mexico. But what transpired was a rather heated discussion between Bill Clinton and the CIA's designee from Washington concerning damage control for the Clinton gubernatorial administration.
Now, let me get this straight. You're saying you can place Bill Clinton directly in the Iran-Contra loop?
I certainly can. And, you know, I almost wish I couldn't, because I feel a lot of my legal problems stem from the fact that Clinton thrust himself into that meeting, but basically exposing himself to all of us that were attending, and thus, in essence, compromising himself.
Who did he compromise himself to?
Well, certainly me. You know, I was asked to come in to cover the loose technical ends of my transfer to Guadalajara. The man who I was scheduled to have a one-on-one discussion with was a man who I knew as Max Gomez, who was going to be my new handler in Mexico. Beyond that, John Cathy, my old CIA handler from Oklahoma City, was there. Aki Sawahata, who was the local CIA resident case officer in Little Rock, he attended the meeting. And in addition to that, the person that was supposed to come in and represent the state's interest was a man named Bob Nash, who was the director of Arkansas Development and Finance Authority.
Terry, I've read your book. Now, most of these people weren't really using their real names, were they? They had code names, right?
Well, you know, I would find years later that I was orbiting in some pretty high circles, some very high echelons, that even to this day still impress me. Let's try to decode these guys. First of all, John Cathy is, in fact, Oliver North. Secondly, Max Gomez. Now, that's interesting. Gomez is, in fact, Felix Rodriguez. Rodriguez, not only being an ex-CIA agent going back to the Bay of Pigs, the Phoenix Project in Vietnam, Felix Rodriguez is a close confidant of George Bush's, and the man who tracked down and was even around during the assassination of Che Guevara. Che Guevara being Fidel Castro's lieutenant. Beyond that, we had Aki Sawahata, still a mystery man to me. We still don't know his real identity. But the man named Robert Johnson is actually William P. Barr, who was later the Attorney General for George Bush. Now, I believe I've named everyone, but there were two people that we think were still using their correct names, and that being Bob Nash and Bill Clinton.
Of course, we know now Bill Clinton's real name isn't Bill Clinton. Let's get back to the discussions of damage control.
Well, you've already witnessed the frustration of several police officers who just could not get the MENA story to go forward. Their investigations seemed to be contained or undermined, short-circuited, whatever you want to call them. In that bunker meeting, I witnessed the containment effort for this entire scandal, and quite frankly, it's shocking to realize all it took was for the authority of two U.S. attorneys to be undermined. The language that was used was that these guys would basically get religion. And if our system of checks and balances is that fragile, something's wrong. But obviously that's what went on, because the rest is history. There were no indictments handed up.
So two U.S. attorneys were somehow told just to back off? Is that right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, so-called national security interest can undermine the whole Justice Department if a sitting attorney general is not in the marching orders given him by the president, and in this case, the director of the CIA.
So how many times did you meet with Bill Clinton?
Actually, on three separate occasions, only two of which I'm free to discuss on this interview. The third may come up in my court case in Little Rock, Arkansas. But you've heard about the first one, the one in the so-called bunker meeting. The second one took place outside of a Mexican food restaurant in Little Rock named Juanita's. That brief encounter, impromptu encounter, was to discuss my moving on down to Mexico to help set up the CIA's front company at the Guadalajara airport.
Terry, why would Clinton care if you moved to Mexico or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in hindsight, I'm sure Bill Clinton saw me as a liability. You know, considering what all I had seen while I worked there with the Central Intelligence Agency, considering the social circles I was orbiting in, well, I'm sure he was just, as quite frankly, wanted me as far from Little Rock, Arkansas as he could get me.
So in other words, he wanted you out of Dodge City, right?
Well, yeah, that's right. There were no threatening comments, but he made it very clear while sitting there in his van outside the restaurant that he wanted me to go ahead and continue with my plans to move to Mexico to fulfill my obligation with the CIA.
You moved to Mexico to set up this front company for the CIA. Sounds exciting.
Well, you know, quite frankly, it got a little more exciting than I had bargained for. My job was really just to move to the Guadalajara airport, set up a company, Machinery International, who was to be a bona fide company, a company to operate in the machine tool industry, a company to bring in equipment to help automate Mexico. Now, of course, covertly, it was to perform services for the U.S. government.
Just exactly what did these covert services include?
Phase one of the plan was pretty simple. This company was to store, warehouse, safeguard, transship weapons, weapons that were destined ultimately for Central America. Phase two of the plan, however, which I found much more interesting, was that Machinery International would serve as a controlling entity to actually manufacture weapons on Mexican soil.
Were the plans implemented?
Well, I moved my family to Mexico in July of 1986, but phase one of the plan was abruptly interrupted in October of that same year due to the C-123 shootdown. That incident caused us all to basically lie low for a while. However, by January of 1987, we all breathed a sigh of relief and decided to go forward with the plan, thinking that the Mexican side of the enterprise hadn't really been discovered. Phase two, just as we were starting into phase two, I was sort of taken out of the operation due to what I call as a rift with my CIA handlers.
Terry, tell us about that rift. In the book, you keep us on the edge of our seats while you negotiate your way out of Mexico. But this was a little more than a casual rift. This was life and death stuff.
Well, you know, my agreement with the CIA was to transship weapons, plain and simple. No one had ever discussed transshipment of drugs with me. If they had, I wouldn't have been involved in any of this. But by early 1987, I had proved to myself beyond a shadow of a doubt that some of the people I was working with were using my facility and using the aircraft. They were hauling the weapons in order to transship cocaine back to the United States.
How much cocaine?
Literally tons. You know, we're not talking kilos here, but tons.
So there is no war on drugs?
Not from what I ever saw, at least not while operating out of Guadalajara. You know, my whole problem began when I took Nancy Reagan's advice and tried to say no to the drug trafficking side of this story.
Did you have any evidence of the CIA's drug trafficking through your facilities? Any witnesses?
Yes, in fact, there was a very credible witness, and I might add he's been thoroughly deposed about his observations of cocaine being transshipped through my Guadalajara warehouse.
In the book, you detailed a trip to San Miguel de Allende, a town in Mexico, where you confronted Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez, with your evidence that his operation was in the drug business. Tell us about that meeting.
First of all, there's a witness to that meeting. I planned it that way. I took a Mexican citizen friend of mine, a man named Patrick Juin, to basically serve as my insurance policy. I strategically positioned Patrick in a restaurant so he could observe Max Gomez, a.k.a. Felix Rodriguez, and Rodriguez could observe him. You know, I kid you not, I was frightened. The good side is Patrick didn't have to witness a homicide. And, of course, the bad side is things didn't turn out as we agreed in that meeting.
So you and Mr. Gomez came to an amicable agreement? He considered you a loose cannon, right? I mean, you wouldn't go along with the drug trafficking. You just waltzed out of there?
Well, that's what happened, although I did have a major bargaining chip. I was in possession of evidence that concretely proved that cocaine had been transshipped through my warehouse by CIA people.
What kind of concrete evidence?
Well, I had samples of shipment that I had found in my warehouse in Guadalajara, July 5th, 1987. You see, I had the wherewithal to safeguard a few kilos just to be used as evidence, seeing as how my handlers kept complaining I lacked concrete evidence. It was mutually agreed upon that I didn't have what it took to be a CIA agent, and I should probably leave Mexico. So eventually it was agreed upon that my wife and I and our three sons could travel back to the U.S. unharmed.
But you were double-crossed, weren't you? I mean, you do say in the book you found out you weren't dealing with honorable men.
Correct. And that's where this story gets real personal and real scary. Shortly after my family and I crossed the Rio Grande, we were able to ascertain that there had been a computer profile created on us that labeled us pretty much a modern-day Bonnie and Clyde. That profile showed us as being armed and dangerous. It said that we carried concealed weapons, had been known to use them in the past. Of course, it labeled me as a high-profile drug trafficker operating out of Central and South America. And besides that, we found out that people were actively trying to determine our whereabouts.
What did you think they wanted?
Well, most assuredly, they wanted me to meet the same demise as Barry Seal. They wanted me and my wife dead.
Terry, did you ever find out who created the false computer profile of you and your wife?
And yes, that person is Bill Clinton's old chief of security, Arkansas State Police Captain Raymond Buddy Young. Now, Mr. Young is no longer with the Arkansas State Police, however. Mr. Young is now with FEMA, or Federal Emergency Management Authority, for the Southwest out of Denton, Texas.
But you and your wife have sued Buddy Young and the others who say you were involved in this ordeal, correct?
Yeah, the criminal justice system was obviously used against me and my wife by some very powerful, selfish, and cowardly individuals. We've sued the people that we feel we can prove helped orchestrate the wrongful criminal indictment against us. I'm not going to sleep until I can drag those people to court. They have to be held accountable for their actions. In fact, the federal judge who acquitted me said that Young and another ex-trooper had what he called demonstrated a reckless disregard for the truth. Now, Harry Truman, my old hero, wouldn't have been so kind with his selection of words. Harry would have said, they are blatant liars who perjure themselves as they try desperately to get me and my wife convicted on trumped-up felony charges, just to destroy my credibility. But I'm still willing to give the system its chance to work and drag those who attempt to destroy me to justice.
Terry, do you feel threatened? I mean, you're obviously making some very powerful people very, very nervous.
Sure, I'm human. And I operate under a continuous threat of not only to my person, but my family as well. You know, our phones have been bugged. We've had burglaries. I've had a written death threat pasted on top of a cover page of Time magazine. These are cowardly people who it's difficult to tell what they'd resort to once we get them fully cornered. But I can tell you this, I know what they're most frightened of, and it's a court of law.
Come now and meet the woman, Janice Reed, who was needlessly and mercilessly targeted and pursued by government agents. Meet Terry Reed's wife, the woman who has stood steadfast by his side during this strenuous ordeal. Janice, tell us, what is it like to marry a spy, to live a double life as the wife of a spy?
It was an interesting situation in that we were dealing with the FBI, the CIA, and the KGB, and it was hard to tell who was whom.
When you and Terry decided to get married, who did he tell you he was spying for?
It was with the FBI in a relationship with the CIA.
Did you meet some of the other agents and spies Terry was working with?
Yes, I met quite a few. He was dealing with several international people, a lot of Japanese, a lot of Hungarians, and then someone who surfaced later in the news that I met as John Cathy. He later surfaced as Oliver North, but I did meet him in Oklahoma City.
Do you have any distinct memories of Oliver North?
Well, as a matter of fact, he happened to be in town when I gave birth to my oldest son, Duncan. And John Cathy, who later became known to me as Oliver North, came by the hospital with Terry and brought roses and offered his congratulations.
When you moved to Little Rock and Terry began working with Oliver North's Contra training program, did you know then what he was doing?
Yes, to a certain extent. Peripherally, I knew what he was involved with. I preferred not to know all the details, and obviously he was not going to tell me all the details.
What was his main job in the Barry Seal operation?
It ultimately ended up working in the MENA, Arkansas area, training Contra pilots.
Who were some of the Arkansas's power elite that Terry's CIA assignment put him into play with?
I mentioned Webster Hubbell. Of course, my husband was acquainted with Bill Clinton, Vincent Foster, a lot of that group from the Rose Law Firm were acquaintances.
After Arkansas, you and Terry moved to Mexico to work for the CIA. How did you like living in Mexico?
I fell in love with it. I mean, the people are so genuine and just wonderful, warm people. And I found it being a wonderful experience for my family.
How many children did you have when you moved there?
When we moved there, I had two. When we left, I had three.
These are all boys?
All little boys.
What was Terry doing for the CIA in Mexico, and what happened?
Terry was involved in, he had a front company. That's what was going on. We had a legitimate manufacturing operation going on down there. but in the summer of 1987, he came across some drugs, cocaine as a matter of fact, a large shipment. And once he became aware of that and I became aware of that, we decided this is not what we're down here for. We were being used and we just wanted away from it.
was the role of the front company? A CIA front company normally has more than one purpose.
Terry has a manufacturing background, and he's technology is one of his true loves. He was involved in high-tech machine tool equipment, shipping it down to Mexico, trying to start up businesses down there, which is very legitimate. It's what was going on then and it's what is still going on now. Through this company, he also allowed weapons to be shipped through the company, and he was aware of that and went along with that. What we weren't aware of is crates were being shipped back through his company back into the United States by agents down there, and they were shipments of drugs and cocaine. And this was done with the knowledge of the U.S. government.
When you became aware of this, how did you react?
Oh, I was terrified. I did not want any part of the drug world. That whole world, they have their own set of rules. I was down there. I was a mother. I had a family. I had three little boys to think about. That's not what I bargained for. I wanted out, and Terry did too.
How did you and Terry extricate yourselves from this dangerous environment?
It was just an automatic overreaction. Terry and I sat down, decided how we're going to get out of this mess. And over the course of about a month, we tried to set things in play that would get us out of there. It ended up with a fairly argumentative confrontation with one of his handlers down there, and it was not a pleasant scene. And he said, well, okay, well, we're just going back to the States. We went out of here. I don't want any more to do with this, and we're gone. And we left, and that's when our troubles began.
What were your plans as you left Mexico?
We thought we were going to the States to get help, to see Oliver North, to see the people that were behind setting us up in Mexico. We thought, well, we'll just tell them what's going on. They'll understand. They'll take care of it. We're very naive.
After returning to the U.S., what happened?
Bit by bit, we found out how deeply we were involved in this. And Terry found out more and more how much inside the inner circle he was, unwittingly and unknowingly. And based on that, I was very much a part of that, too, by virtue of the fact I was married to him. Once we got back to the States, we found out our parents were getting phone calls, suspicious phone calls, wanting to know our whereabouts. When agents started showing up at the doorstep of my mother-in-law and my parents saying they were looking for us, we got the message real fast that this was not going to be fun.
So you were being painted as drug traffickers and agents of the U.S. government were looking for you?
They went to my sister, they went to my mother, they went to my father, they went to Terry's 72-year-old mother and threatened. They threatened family members saying, you turn over your children, tell us where they are. If you don't, you're in trouble with the law, too, and you can be incarcerated. When we were dealing with that, with our elderly parents, seeing them being threatened, we knew this was for real, and they weren't going to be understanding. They were after us.
What did you do then?
At that point in time, we decided we're going to take off. We're going to run because, obviously, they were not being reasonable. They did not want to hear our side of the story.
How does it feel to be pursued by government agents when you've done nothing wrong?
But during the course of this, when I realized I had no one to turn to, I had no place to go. I was a citizen wronged, but where could I go? The people I felt I should be able to go to were the people that were after me. That, the level of despair when I realized that, like, I am a person without a country. That was something that was very difficult to deal with.
So you and Terry fled for your lives.
Yes. In fact, we had a motorhome and three little boys and a German Shepherd dog. And we took off, not having any idea where we were headed. Initially, we had felt that there was someone in Washington that was going to help us. But we soon came to learn we were being double-crossed. We had no idea. Nothing can prepare you for this sort of shock.
How do you feel?
My husband is a very patriotic person, as well as I am. And the fact that we thought we were doing the right thing, and helping our government, helping our country, and then to have this happen, I can't tell you what it does to you as a human being. The trauma and the shock and the despair one feels, and the loneliness, thinking it's just us out here being chased.
What was your loneliest moment?
During the course of all this, when all this came about, my father had a stroke. I was there at the hospital with him when all this came down on us. I had to leave in the middle of the night with my family, and I had to make a decision. If I leave my father now, I may never see him again, but I also have three children that are depending on me, and someone is wanting to take me away from them. And I had to make a decision. It was very, very, that was probably the most difficult point of my life, when I had to leave my father in the hospital. I felt very alone, and the despair was almost more than I could imagine and bear.
How did you deal this pain?
I guess when you work through all these phases, like the shock, the denial, the anger, you know, Terry and I had to work through that in about 48 hours. I mean, we had to get through it. If we had wallowed in that and gone through all those phases, we would have been captured. We didn't have time for that. We had too many. Our children relied on us, and we had too many responsibilities. So we worked that real fast and then got into the survival mode.
Where did you run to initially?
We ended up in San Diego. We spent Christmas in San Diego. We thought that's right near the border. And Terry's thought was that's the last place that the Reeds would go. That would be a stupid place to hang out is at the border. They might be combing the borders. So do the unexpected. I mean, he had years of intelligence training, and you know, in that facet of this whole saga, I mean, he relied on his training, and it saved us.
Dennis, what sticks in your mind about that period of your life?
It was just the feeling of despair I had that Christmas, knowing I was a wanted fugitive, and watching everyone around. In the Christmas spirit, all the families singing, caroling, watching the Christmas specials. I felt I had so much pain that Christmas, but I had to. I made a true attempt to keep up a facade for the children, you know, trying to sing carols with them, make Christmas ornaments. You know, it was all. I felt like remote control. I was just a robot going through the motions. But the pain that was my worst Christmas ever.
How old were your children that Christmas?
Baxter was a baby. He was 6 months old. Elliot was 2.5, and Duncan had just turned 5.
Did you do anything else in San Diego besides celebrate a tense Christmas?
Well, not knowing what was going on within the national computer system or the law enforcement system, we definitely were not comfortable being Terry and Janet Reed. We spent the time in San Diego establishing a corporation, establishing new identities, and once we had that taken care of, we were a little more comfortable leaving. We definitely did not want to stay there for any length of time, and we felt more comfortable being removed from our previous persons, to Terry and Janice Reed.
Where did you go then?
We left San Diego and eventually ended up in Maine, which is about as far as we could drive.
As you wandered around America, how did you control your fear and your anxiety?
Yeah, I had to focus on one day at a time, and that was as a mother, as a school teacher. It was not as a fugitive from our government, and that's what kept me going. We had a motorhome. I decorated it. I put the alphabet chart up, the numbers, George Washington. We had a little school session going every day, and we had some great geography lessons. I mean, he went to most of the national parks. We saw Old Faithful. We saw Niagara Falls, and the children are standing in front of all these national monuments. We've got all kinds of photos that year. And
these government agents who were tampering in law enforcement computers, how did they portray you? What kind of lies did these renegade agents insert into the computers?
I later found out, after I obtained my FBI file through discovery, that we had been labeled armed and dangerous as very nefarious characters, and that was so frightening.
Who were you the most frightened of?
I'm not saying the FBI is a bad agency or the CIA. Our concern was the renegade agents out there that are totally out of control. And that's who I was most frightened of. And the power they can wield, they are legitimate agents, and the power they have to alter your profile in NCIC. I had done nothing other than being married to Terry Reed.
What was Terry doing throughout all of this?
He's a very calculating person. He had his manual for flight instruction and how to deal with stress under pressure, and he would want me to read all these manuals, and I'd go, no, that's not the way I operate. You know, I mean, he can sit there, remove himself from the situation, and know how he should react. I'm more emotional. I can't sit there and read how to deal with stress and just incorporate that. That's obviously much easier said than done. I got a lot of strength from him, as well as he got a lot of strength from me. He knew I was there to take care of the children. That facet of his life was being cared for by me. I knew he was there to get us out of this mess. I mean, I had to have his belief that with his training and his background and knowledge that he would somehow get us out. He monitored that phase. I took care of the nurturing, the maternal, the family, and he relied on me for that. We needed each other.
Janice, what if you got separated or one of you was arrested? Had Terry covered that contingency?
We had a plan. Terry always had plan A, B, and C in envelopes, in code talk, and I had to have those memorized. We knew where we were going to rendezvous or what each plan was.
Now, how long did this last? How long were you on the run?
Over 6 months we were on the run. After that length of time, you just start to question, what are we doing? We obviously had evaded them. Terry did a very good job keeping us out of harm's way. It got to the point, though, we did feel very threatened. I've been asked before, what were you prepared to do? When I felt as a mother threatened, I would have been prepared to do anything. In fact, I got to the point, I did get a Smith & Wesson 38 caliber featherweight, and I carried it in our diaper bag. It was with me at all times, because I never knew if someone was going to come barging in the door. That could happen. If they had located us, if they had put a monitor on us, they could have found us easily, barging our door in the middle of the night and trying to take us away. I was prepared to shoot. Being responsible for three little boys, I felt very capable of doing what I needed to do.
How did you feel the day you stopped running?
I think we were just so worn out. I guess we still had this hope, and Terry had enough contact thinking someone might be able to take care of this up the line. I mean, we wanted to think that. We were told that was going on. We just didn't know. But you just get to the point, you can't do this forever. We're not being fair to our children, our families, ourselves, going through this trauma.
Then what transpired?
2.5 years in the criminal justice system. And that, I can tell you, is no fun. Our troubles were just beginning.
What do you believe led to your charges?
There was never any evidence on my part that I should ever have been indicted. In fact, I sat in the federal court one day, and the judge said, pointed to me and goes, well, I can't figure out why she's here. And none of us could, other than the fact I had a marriage license, and I'd married Terry Reed, and that's why I was there. I was used as a pawn. To get back at Terry. I was approached on numerous occasions saying, hey, you tell us everything you know, you tell us everything about your husband and we'll let you go. Well, first of all, I had nothing to say, and second of all, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I can't be used as a pawn. I was offended that they were trying to use me for that and putting me through the pain of the indictment process. We were both up for 20 years. I mean, living with that every day, and dragging on for 2.5 years, I mean, it's amazing we survived.
Why was Terry charged?
He was set up. The problem with Terry was, in some of these activities, covert activities, there's often people from the criminal world that get involved. CIA, FBI, they like to use drug smugglers or former criminals or pilots that have a record because, you know, they're compromised. Terry had no record. I mean, he had a squeaky clean background, so, you know, they need something to set him up with, which is what happened.
Was it a nightmare being in the criminal justice system?
Yes, as a matter of fact, being involved in the criminal justice system for as long as we were was a rude awakening. I found out that justice is not out there unless you have a whole lot of money. I hate to say that, but we were forced to liquidate everything we had. We had a little money at the time. That was all depleted immediately. We were forced to get two different attorneys, which, because of conflict, they tried to turn me against him. And after 2.5 years, we did not declare bankruptcy. However, our credit was ruined. We were nearly destitute after the fact, after we were found innocent through freedom of information. We found documents that would have totally exonerated us that the prosecution had within their, within their office that they suppressed. So the shock and the horror just continued. Initially, it was all physical, emotional, and later it was just the shock of this is the way it works, and no one is held accountable. That's what's so wrong. I sat there in the courtroom watching a prosecutor point the finger at me saying I deserve to be locked up when I had done nothing. I was found innocent. Terry was found innocent. We walked out of the courtroom that day. It's like, adios. It's been nice. It's like there's no restitution. Our lives were destroyed. Financially and emotionally, we were just devastated. It's like, sorry, I guess we made a mistake. But they don't even say that. You know, you walk out with a piece of paper, not guilty. You know, goodbye. Our system is out of control. There is no check and balance, and that's what's frightening.
Feel this is the way the system has always worked, or have things changed?
Now, this is not the America I grew up with. In fact, I can't believe this is America. I can't believe this is what our system has degenerated to. I want to go back in time. I grew up in the 50s. I want to start over. We need to start looking back the way it used to be when people were honest, when people were accountable. That's what needs to happen, because this is not the America I grew up with.
What would you like to tell the American people about the corruption within the Justice Department?
We were discussing how I felt when we were acquitted. We went through a very brief period where we thought, well, let's just start all over. You know, let's just pick up where we left off. Well, we found we couldn't do that. We had gone through too much just to walk away from it. I knew Terry would... He couldn't live with himself. When you sit in federal court and watch state troopers and government officials sit there and perjure themselves, and the prosecutor knows that, that's not right.
But Janice, you're fighting within an obviously corrupt system. Do you honestly think you can win?
Well, I'm a 60s person. I mean, that's inherent. That's an inherent part of me. I still have this sense of right will prevail, and I think sometimes I'm terribly stupid to think that, but Terry and I got acquitted. I didn't think that would happen. I'm committed. I do have this belief that we can make a difference.
Rangers and deputies hired by the rich.
Now, we've got to stop there due to time. There's 17 minutes more of that video. The last 5 minutes is an appeal for funds for the Reed Court Offensive. That, unfortunately, foundered in 1996 when U.S. District Judge George Howard Jr. ruled that because he claimed their evidence was, quote, based on conjecture, speculation, and coincidence, unquote, then he would not allow any evidence about Terry Reed's missions with the FBI, the CIA, anything to do with Bill Clinton, Barry Seal, or Dan Lasseter. Now, an interesting decision there, especially when one bears in mind that Judge George Howard Jr. was a personal appointee of Governor Bill Clinton. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to download them 100 at a time, you can do that at unwelcomeguests.net/downloads. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Like you're riding to help these poor ones.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Arne Gundersen, What Did They Know? When Did They Know It? On the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, the new Japanese state secrets law, enacted in 2014, limits information and threatens journalists with jail time. And even Western media make it appear as if the worst has passed. Acknowledging the reality of this accident with global consequences at least 100 years into the future is not only frightening for just plain folk, but economically devastating to the energy corporations. When former nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen was asked by his family in early 2011 where the next nuclear power plant accident would take place, he said he was unable to say where, but that he was convinced that it would be a Mark I or Mark II General Electric design. 3 weeks later, the Fukushima Daiichi Mark I reactors melted down. Almost a quarter of the so-called fleet of nuclear reactors in the U.S. are of that same design as Fukushima Daiichi. If you live in New York City, Boston, Minneapolis, Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, or Wilmington, you are threatened by one or more of these vulnerable Mark I or II reactors. Only one of them was closed since Fukushima. The Vermont Yankee was shut down on December 29, 2014. The reason Arne Gundersen is so familiar with this design is that he was an engineer on the Millstone Mark I reactor and a nuclear insider until he was fired in 1990 for pointing out security flaws. Today he publishes on the website fairwinds.org. Here's a speech he gave at the Fukushima Symposium 2013 that is as brilliantly up-to-date today as it was then. Arne Gundersen, What Did They Know? When Did They Know It? He and his website Fairwinds became well-known and respected after the Fukushima accident for his often weekly updated reports. He continues to fill the void left by the unwillingness of TEPCO, the operator of Fukushima Daiichi, and the Japanese government to disclose full details of the accident and the cleanup. Gundersen holds an MA in nuclear engineering and once worked for the nuclear industry. He was an expert witness on the Three Mile Island partial meltdown and, more recently, on the serious safety risks at the Vermont Yankee and California San Onofre reactors. While Arne Gundersen, almost 50 years ago, was working on the General Electric Mark I type boiling water reactor Millstone near Waterford, Connecticut, plans were finalized about the construction of the almost identical first nuclear reactor for Fukushima. And as you will hear now, Gundersen argues that the 2011 Fukushima Daiichi accident in Japan began then and there in 1965 inside the U.S. on the drawing boards of the engineers in New York City who designed the site plan and architecture for the Mark I reactor at Fukushima. Gundersen also points the finger at the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission that permitted a flawed design to be licensed and built. Here is Arne Gundersen.
The Fukushima Daiichi accident was made in America. The reactor was designed by General Electric and built by a company called Evasco. I used to go to the Evasco offices right here in Manhattan when I was an engineer on Millstone Unit 1, which was almost identical to Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1. It was licensed by the Atomic Energy Commission, which at the time, in the 1960s, was the ultimate authority on nuclear licensing in the world. At least we thought that to be the case. This is not just a Daiichi issue. There's 22 other plants in the United States that are similar. And the plants in the United States are in some ways much worse because there's a lot more waste fuel in their spent fuel pools than there were at Daiichi. The engineers at General Electric and at Ibasco made six critical mistakes in 1965 that were to doom Japan in 2011. The first five critical mistakes all revolve around the issue of not really understanding the power of a tsunami. They reduced the height of the cliff that the plant was built on. They built a short tsunami wall. The diesels were placed in the basement. The emergency pumps, called the service water pumps, were placed in a situation where they were underwater. And finally, the diesel tanks were placed in a place where they, too, were flooded. These were engineers based here in New York City that simply didn't understand the power of a tsunami. The last issue on the Mark I containment is a little broader, and I'll get onto that as well. The cliff at Fukushima Daiichi in 1960 was 35 meters high, about 115 feet high. The engineers at GE and Ibasco cut it down to 10 meters, so it was a 30-foot cliff. Well, tsunami is a Japanese word coming from tsu, meaning harbor, and nami, meaning waves. The entire ocean rises up. If you're on a boat, you don't notice a tsunami because the entire ocean rises up, except when it hits a harbor, and then it becomes terrifying. It travels at close to the speed of sound. Engineers knew of tsunamis, and I thought I'd just go back 100 years in Japanese history to look at Pacific Coast tsunamis that hit Japan. In 1896, there was a 40-meter tsunami. 1923, there was a 13-meter tsunami. 1933, there was a 28-meter tsunami. And this was the tsunami of record as far as killing people before the Daiichi tsunami. 1944, there was a 12-meter tsunami. 46, another 12-meter tsunami. In 54 and 55, 10 years before Fukushima Daiichi was designed, there were three tsunamis, and all of them were over 13 meters. The tsunami that hit Fukushima Daiichi in 2011 was just a middle-of-the-road tsunami compared to the 100-year history before it. But in face of that history, the tsunami wall was built by American engineers at 4 meters and later raised to 5.7 meters. In addition, the diesels were placed in the basement. Now, diesels can be placed in the basement, but you should be able to put them in some sort of a waterproof container, which did not occur. It's important to know that General Electric built these first dozen or so Mark I reactors on what's called a turnkey contract. They took $60 million and built these plants, and they lost their shirt. I know because I worked on one of these turnkey reactors, Millstone 1, around the same time. So there was a lot of economic pressures on General Electric to keep the cost down because they were losing money dramatically on the dozen reactors they had built on this turnkey process. In addition, the service water pumps had to be at the water, but they were designed so that in any tsunami they would have been flooded. So it doesn't matter that the diesels were in the basement. If the diesels had been on top of the Empire State Building, we'd have the same problem because the cooling pumps that cool the diesels would have been flooded. In addition, the fuel tanks that provide fuel for the diesels were also in the floodplain. So again, it's not about the diesels being flooded. It's about engineers here in New York City, General Electric engineers and Ibasco engineers, who didn't appreciate the magnitude of a tsunami. Now, there's some political issues going on as well. General Electric whose motto, by the way, in 1960 was progress is our most important product, said in 1961, they said, we're going to ram this nuclear thing through. Their chairman is quoted as saying that. And ram it through they did. They met with the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, which in theory is an independent body designed to protect Americans in this case, but those design decisions were driven into the Japanese design as well. And Dr. David Ockrent, who was on the advisory committee, basically said that General Electric threatened them going out of business unless the advisory committee continued with this Mark I design. Scientists in the United States, 1965, recognized that this Mark I design had flaws. And as Dr. Ockrent said, I think it was kind of a threat. Now, Glenn Seaborg was the chairman of the advisory committee at that time, and he actually has an atom named after him. He's got an element, a seaborgium, named after him. This is a heavy hitter in the nuclear industry. And he said, I don't think we had the power to stop them. Now, think about that. This is the United States government didn't have the power to stop General Electric's faulty design in 1966. Just about the time the Daiichi units were starting up in 72, there's a famous letter exchange with a senior scientist at General Electric named Joseph Hendry. And Mr. Hendry said that he had serious doubts about the Daiichi design, the Mark I containment. But as I've highlighted at the end, he said that he felt they should be eliminated. But in eliminating this Mark I design, quote, it could well mean the end of nuclear power, creating more turmoil than I could stand. So the turmoil he chose to avoid in 1972 became the turmoil that Fukushima Daiichi experienced 40 years later. So when this plant started up, a Made in America design, all of the critical problems that Daiichi was to face 40 years later were in place. Essentially, the fuse was lit on Fukushima Daiichi in 1970, and it exploded in 2011.
That was Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer and head of Fairwinds Associates. He gives regular updates on Fukushima Daiichi. Gundersen spoke in New York City on March 11, 2013, at a two-day symposium on the second anniversary of the accident. All six reactors at Fukushima Daiichi are of the dangerous Mark I or Mark II design developed by General Electric. General Electric and Ibasco are responsible for the reactors and the architectural design of Units 1, 2, and 6. Toshiba or Hitachi are responsible for Units 3, 4, and 5. As he continues with his talk, Arne Gundersen describes how the earthquake and tsunami affected the six reactor units. One by one, he goes through some of the assumptions at the basis of the permit process for nuclear power plants. Given that so many experts in the late 60s and early 70s warned that the design of the General Electric Mark I and II was unsafe, regulators made specific assumptions that certain incidents were just never going to happen. Please bear with some of the technical detail. Almost a quarter of the so-called fleet of nuclear reactors in the U.S. are of that same design as Fukushima Daiichi. You do not have to fear a tsunami, but the loss of off-site power, possibly the most serious danger to any nuclear power plant, can also be caused by wind or ice storms, and they are becoming increasingly frequent. When heavy winter storms hit New England in early February 2013, the Pilgrim nuclear power station in Plymouth, Mass., lost outside power for several days. Pilgrim is a General Electric Mark I design. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry claim to have learned from the Fukushima accident. Far from considering shutting down all Mark I and II nuclear power plants, they are now fighting over whether the industry may be asked to put filters on the vents of the containments. As you may remember, at Fukushima Daiichi, the vents were opened to release huge amounts of hydrogen and radioactive gases into the environment to prevent, in vain, as it became obvious, explosions of the reactor containments. The largest nuclear power company in the U.S., Exelon, say that the $20 to $25 million for filters per unit is too much to pay. Marketplace reported the story on February 21, 2013. They said, without the filters, those vents might become a kind of radioactive fire hose, spewing radiation into the air. Now, in 2016, the filters still have not been added, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted 3-1 in August 2015 not to allow public comment or to go forward with proposed rulemaking and safety retrofits to all General Electric Mark I and II boiling water reactors in the U.S. We may have to wait till 2019 to see any results. Here's part two of the presentation by Arne Gundersen.
If we fast forward 40 years, this is the completest site right before the accident. The earth sunk a meter, 3 feet, after the earthquake. The tsunami was 15 meters high. But remember, it's moving at the speed of sound, so the wave, when it hit the plant, actually crested at 46 meters high, over top of all these buildings. So how bad was it? When we're evaluating the dose consequences of Fukushima Daiichi, the secret is in the assumptions, which is where I'll spend the rest of this presentation. Assumption one is that containments maintain their integrity. After all, they are called containments for a reason. They're meant to contain. No containment in the world is designed to handle a detonation shockwave. That's a shockwave that travels faster than the speed of sound. There's 440 nuclear reactors, and none of them can handle a detonation shockwave because engineers believed that it couldn't happen. Well, right after it did happen, it's interesting that the NRC's own Chuck Castle, now he's a senior guy, he's in charge of the NRC's Region 3 out of their Chicago office. A very senior guy at the NRC said this, of course, that Mark I containment is the worst containment we have. And if you have something called a loss of offsite power or station backout, you are going to lose the containment. There's no doubt about it. So remember that Mr. Hendry at the NRC in 1972 said this was the worst containment in the world. And here's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying the same thing immediately after the accident. We've known for 40 years that this Mark I design, like at Daiichi, was an accident waiting to happen. And of course, you've all seen the devastation that a detonation shockwave can occur. Containments were meant to contain, and this is not supposed to happen. Assumption number two is containment leakage. Now, what happened inside the Daiichi reactor was that the pressures got so high that the bolts that hold the containment together began to stretch. And hot radioactive gases and hot radioactive steam began to leak out, and hydrogen. Now, in addition to the hydrogen that was created in the fuel, there was already a meltdown in process, and that fuel was now lying up against concrete. The concrete was liberating hydrogen as well. So we had two sources of hydrogen after the Daiichi accident. The fuel, as it created something called the Zirk water reaction, zirconium water reaction. But we also had the meltdown was causing more hydrogen because the hot fuel was in contact with concrete, and that was liberating hydrogen as well. Now, the NRC assumes that containments leak at 1% a day. So in a room this size, what we're saying is that over 100 days, the gases in this room would leave and fresh gases would come in behind it. But what the NRC said in a phone call on March 23rd is that the reactors at Daiichi were leaking at 300% per day. That means that the gases inside Daiichi were leaving the containment every 8 hours. Whatever radiation was getting out of that nuclear fuel was being liberated to the environment within 8 hours because the containment leak rate was 300% per day, not 1% like the NRC assumes. Assumption number three is noble gases. Now, if you remember your high school chemistry, raise your hands if you do. I don't see many hands. Oh, I do. The far right of the periodic table is our noble gases, things like xenon and krypton. They're called noble because they don't react with anything. Nuclear fuel is loaded with noble gases, and as long as the fuel retains its integrity, the gases are trapped inside. Well, the fuel didn't retain its integrity, and all the noble gases were released. The data indicates that over Chiba, the xenon, which is a noble gas concentration, was 400,000 times normal immediately after the accident. And also that the concentration of xenon in Chiba was 1,300 becquerels per cubic meter for 8 days. Now, a cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And think about it. Inside every cubic meter of air over Chiba, there were 1,300 disintegrations emitting radioactivity every second for 8 days. What were those people breathing? Gases with noble gases, which can't be monitored now. They're gone. So I think one of the issues here is that the Japanese government has no idea how much exposure the people in Chiba got from this cloud of noble gases that were released. This is important data that just came out. Mainichi covered this story, but it's actually Fukushima Prefecture data, and it's only a couple of days old. There were four radiation detectors that continued to work after the Daiichi accident. Almost all of them didn't have power, but a couple were battery-powered, and they just recently discovered the data. Normal background on these radiation detectors was about 0.04 microsieverts. At 5 o'clock in the morning, right after the accident, the radiation in the detectors was 10 times background. 6 o'clock, 60 times background. 9 o'clock, 150 times background. 10 o'clock, 700 times background. What that means is that somebody in the vicinity of these radiation detectors was getting a yearly dose in 12 hours. Then the vents were open. So this is a clear indication that the containments were leaking well before the vents were open. So at 3 o'clock, these same detectors were measuring 30,000 times background. That means a yearly dose in 10 minutes for the people in Chiba. Now, it's also important to realize this may not be the worst. This happens to be where the detector was. But it doesn't mean that the plume chose to go to the detector and get that reading. It's clear that this plume was meandering all over the western side of the plant and the northern side of the plant, even before the vents were open. Assumption number four. The decontamination factor for cesium, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit geeky, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission assumes that after a nuclear accident, the water inside the torus, which is the donut at the bottom of the containment, takes out 99% of the cesium. That's called a decontamination factor of 100. That's actually written into law that they believe that to occur. But they also say that if the water hits boiling, there's no decontamination factor. The water is incapable of capturing any cesium. Well, the data from Fukushima shows that the water in that torus at the bottom of the containment did boil. Why did it boil? Because those cooling pumps I was telling you about that cool the diesel were also designed to cool the torus. So we had boiling water in the torus, and that meant that no cesium was retained. Now, the Japanese, as they're trying to reconstruct this accident, are claiming cesium was captured inside that torus, but the law and the data show that it couldn't be. Now, how do I know that? This is an important slide. It's an infrared image of Unit 3. The large blotch in the center of the screen is the spent fuel pool on Unit 3. And the temperature of the gases coming off the spent fuel pool are 62 degrees centigrade, which means that the fuel is boiling and it's mixing with cold air, and there's a bath of hot radioactive air over the fuel pool at 62 degrees. That's pretty bad. But what's worse is the flare that the drawing shows. Now, TEPCO's known about this for 2 years and has not talked about it. That flare is exactly where the containment should be. And that flare is at 128 degrees Celsius, which means it's not steam. Steam can't exist over 100 degrees. Engineers call this something in the steam tables. But at atmospheric pressure like we are today, when you boil steam, you're only going to get to 100 degrees centigrade. That flare is at 128 degrees, which means that it's not steam. It means it's hot, radioactive gases being released directly from the containment. It also means that inside the containment, it was not below the boiling point of water. It was above the boiling point of water. There was no liquid water inside that containment. This is on March 20th, 9 days after the accident. The containment is venting hot radioactive gases directly to the environment. This is proof positive in my view. And TEPCO, obviously, they're good engineers, and they would have seen that 128 degrees centigrade, about 250 degree hot radioactive flare being released in this infrared picture. So they've known for a long time that huge amounts of cesium were being released directly to the air because they weren't being trapped in the water in the suppression pool. And Prime Minister Khan said, our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. So I think the point is, at what point do the risks of a technology become unacceptable? Well, my conclusion is that sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. Good. Thank you.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The exodus of approximately 6 million black people from the American South between 1915 and 1970 had a significant role in setting the stage of the civil rights movements of the early 1960s. Many of the children of those who left the South participated in desegregation efforts, which included the Freedom Rides and lunch counter sit-ins. The Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, which attempted to resolve employment discrimination and define voting rights, only changed the law. Many young blacks, however, did not see changes in their everyday life. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was born out of this disillusionment. Although infiltrated and feared by the FBI, the Black Panther Party pioneered social and community programs, including free medical clinics, free meals, and educational programs. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Columbia University Sociology and Gender Studies Professor Alondra Nelson, author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. Alondra Nelson and I visited by phone from her office in New York City on February 13, 2012, and began our conversation when I asked her to describe the Black Panther Party.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which was its original name, was, a radical left. They identified as Marxist-Leninist organization. But they were also the children of migrants. They were the children of parents who were refugees from Jim Crow. And so one of the important things I think we should understand about the Black Panther Party is that they emerge in reaction to the dissatisfaction that people still felt, despite the fact that we had had these great social strides with the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 65. The Black Panther Party emerges in October 1966. In the face of the reality that so much has changed, but so much remained to be changed, particularly for poor communities and poor communities of color. So you have that on the one hand. I think it's also important to thinking of them as the children of immigrants, as the children of migrants, rather, like immigrants from all over who have been so central to the founding of American society and the proliferation of American society. They are the children of people who came seeking a new and better life for their children. And so there's a dual disappointment here. There's a disappointment that changing race policies with regard to laws, racial laws in the United States, are not leading to always substantive changes in the experiences of people like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who would co-found the Black Panther Party. But also that there was a kind of, they had a sense of disaffection because the new and better life that their parents had hoped for them also wasn't coming to fruition.
Before we go too much farther, can you describe in brief detail the Great Migration, who migrated, and the circumstances?
Sure. So the Great Migration happened pretty much in two waves. One in the early 20th century, about 1910, 1915, and then there was a second wave around World War II. And but there were people, of course, coming in between those periods. But it was, you know, over the course of, say, 20 or 30 years, you had millions and millions of African Americans moving from the South to the Midwest, in places in the West like Los Angeles and Oakland. And this is a significant demographic shift because for those of you, your listeners who know about the history of slavery and the demography of the plantation South, there were pockets in the South where the population were, part of the sort of paradox of slavery, for example, in the South was that you had communities in which you had 90 or 95% people who were slaves, who were blacks, who were slaves, and you had a distinct minority of whites. And so the South was significantly African American. And so to have millions of people leave changed not only the South, but also the North. And so you had, there were several routes. I mean, there was a route that went often from places like Georgia that went up to the Mid-Atlantic and to the Northeast. So places, people from Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, for example, might end up in Washington, D.C., like my grandparents did, or they might end up in Boston, or they might end up in New Haven, Connecticut. People in the more western southern states like Arkansas and Texas and Louisiana often ended up in, Los Angeles and also Oakland, California.
And can you tell us what the term Black Panthers stands for?
The Black Panther, of course, is a large cat in the wild, but it also has deeply symbolic political meaning. So it was the name of the political party during the Southern, we might call the Southern Civil Rights Struggle. There was a Lowndes County Freedom Party in Lowndes County, Georgia, that was trying to get voting rights for African Americans in the Jim Crow South. And their emblem for this Lowndes County Freedom Party was a Black Panther that looks very much like the iconic Black Panther that we know of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party borrowed freely from the Lowndes County Freedom Party, and they, pay tribute to the fact that they borrowed freely from this emblem. And, it was meant to suggest the blackness of black people, but also a sense of, courage and bravery in the face of segregation and Jim Crow.
Alondra, can you describe the medical discrimination that existed in the 50s and 60s that the Black Panther Party was challenging?
Yes. Medical discrimination is a term that I use quite broadly in the book, and it describes several different factors in the way that people had to deal with forms of professional and inequality and health inequality. So, you know, at least legally up until 1964, you know, we had Jim Crow not only in lunch counters and buses and these sorts of things, we had Jim Crow in medical facilities. So Jim Crow in medical facilities meant in Atlanta, for example, you had the Grady Hospital Tower. So you had two towers, the Grady Hospital Towers, one for black people and one for white people that stood next to each other. You had separate but equal hospital facilities. It also meant that you had often allegedly separate but equal but clearly unequal medical training. So you had black nursing schools and you had white nursing schools. It was also the case that in hospitals where people would be seen, black doctors couldn't get visiting rights in hospitals, so there would be patients that they couldn't see in their hospitals because of their race, even though they were qualified as doctors. So there's a sort of large scale or macro or structural sense of medical discrimination that was about the way that hospitals functioned, the way in which black medical and health professionals could or could not be trained or could or could not have access. It was often the case in the Jim Crow South in particular that they even had, that Jim Crow extended outside of the hospitals to ambulance services so that, you know, if you called a dispatcher because you were bearing witness to someone having a heart attack or someone had been shot or something had befallen someone and they needed emergency transportation to the hospital, the dispatcher would ask you whether or not the person was black or white because they had black and white ambulances. And then based on whether or not the person was black or white, they could decide indiscriminately whether or not they wanted to send an ambulance to a black community, send a black ambulance to the black community. And then there was discrimination in the very practice of medicine. And this is where I think the Panther story is key. So we understand that, you know, even though there was racial inequality in places like Oakland, that it didn't operate in the same way that it did in the South. So you didn't have black ambulances and white ambulances, particularly by the time you get to 1966 when the party emerges. But it was certainly the case that people didn't necessarily have access to health care, and the care that they had access to was often very poor. So the Black Panther Party spends a lot of time both in their writing and their public pronouncements in parks and at various events talking about the sort of experience of a hypothetical sort of person, a poor black person who would go to a hospital, and it would involve things like waiting for a long time in the waiting room to be seen and perhaps not being seen at all after, you know, taking a whole day off from work to wait, having to have an interaction with a doctor who was disrespectful, who didn't take your pain seriously, who didn't take your ailment seriously, who treated you brusquely. Medical discrimination and the way in which the Panthers were dealing with it moved from the large scale of the hospital and the ways hospitals operated to the small scale of how doctors interacted with poor and black patients.
How did the Black Panther Party deal with that on a material plane? What steps did they take?
Yeah, well, I think materially they dealt with this by setting up their own clinics. That was the response to this. You know, if people can't get care, as the Panthers understood they had a right to, and the care that they, you know, should have access to, we're going to start our own clinics. And so by 1970, the Black Panther Party have a national network of health clinics. The national headquarters of the party, the leadership of the party, requires that all chapters have health clinics. And the clinics were they were very local, very community-based, very grassroots organizations. And so they were run with kind of community resources, and each of the chapters were, individual chapters were responsible for getting the clinics up and running. And the clinics did things like, you know, blood pressure screening. Sometimes they gave immunizations. Many of them had, you know, modest pharmacies. The clinics in Berkeley and Chicago actually had pretty well supplied pharmacies. And the clinics also served for the party, I guess, another function. They were a way for people to get access to information about housing or to get support or help if they were dealing with a difficult landlord. It was a way for them to get food, if they needed clothing. So the clinics really took health as health activists had a very broad definition of health. And they understood that all of, you know, that social issues have everything to do with people's health care.
Can you talk about the sickle cell anemia project that the Black Panther Party had in its clinics and its importance to people who may carry that cell?
One of the success stories of the Black Panther Party's health activism is their sickle cell anemia campaign. In 1970, 1971, 72, when the Black Panther Party was involved in sickle cell outreach and testing, very little was known about sickle cell anemia in the public and certainly in Black communities. And part of what the Black Panther Party was engaged in was just raising national awareness about the disease, both for Black communities and that suffer disproportionately from the disease. So it's, you know, politically, the Black Panthers made it and underscored the fact that it was a Black disease. So the Black Panther Party did a lot of public education around the disease that included things like explaining in fine detail the sort of molecular dynamics of the disease in their newspaper. And so the issue that they raised is what we today call racial health disparities. So part of how they rose awareness and were beating the drum around the disease was that they were saying, you know, they exposed the fact that the state was spending lots of money on other genetic diseases that were more likely to affect other communities, and that sickle cell anemia as a disease, by comparison, was neglected. And so it would be quite successful. They would garner in the course of particularly 1972, lots and lots of attention around the disease, such that the Nixon administration, that was, you know, no fan of the Black Panther Party, would increase tenfold in the course of that year the money that the federal government dedicated to the to research into the eradication of sickle cell anemia.
What does sickle cell anemia do to people?
Sickle cell anemia occurs predominantly in people of African descent. The red blood cells are usually round, like, you know, like a donut or like a penny. And sickled cells literally take on the shape of a sickle. So they sort of curve and they're sort of C-shaped or V-shaped. And what that means in the body is that oxygen can't circulate in the bloodstream as well. It often causes pain in the joints, and people are just not getting oxygenated blood circulating through their body. So it affects the organs. It affects, you know, oxygen is the stuff of life. We all need it. When the Panthers were working on sickle cell anemia, it was very much a childhood disease, so that people were dying often before their 20s, often before their teens, if they had the disease, the sickle cell disease, not the marker. Today, people live a lot longer. They can live, you know, until their 40s.
Why is it a disease that is predominant in people with African origins?
The basic reason of any disease, even diseases that are predominant among, say, Ashkenazi Jews, is partly just because of, you know, circumstance and historical factors and et cetera about how people choose to marry. So, I mean, so part of the story of genetic disease is about communities marrying within these small communities over generations again and again and again. And in fact, one of the solutions to genetic diseases, one might say, is for people to sort of intermarry or marry outside of the group that's married traditionally over time. Politically and historically, why it was especially interesting to the Black Panther Party is that in places where there was malaria, so in places, parts of Africa that are malarial belts, the trait for sickle cell anemia is actually a good thing because the trait for sickle cell anemia provides some protection against malaria. But in places like Oakland, that isn't a malarial belt, you know, it loses its genetic advantage or the role that it's supposed to have in natural selection.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Alondra Nelson, a professor of sociology at Columbia University in New York City. She's the author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Professor Alondra Nelson, how would you characterize medical discrimination to people of color now in the United States?
Obviously, things have changed quite a good deal with regards to medical discrimination since 1966 or 1972 when the Black Panther Party were doing their work. I mean, I think it's the case that there's been so much more training and awareness around the importance of how doctors interact with patients. And, you know, it wasn't only the Black Panther Party. It was women's health activism, health activists, and also health activists who were working in new left organizations like Health PAC, who made, you know, the medical profession really aware that they had to treat people with respect. And so that's certainly changed. I mean, there was a time, you know, where people didn't feel empowered to ask questions about their doctors.
I want to ask you about the consequences of the FBI looking at the work of the Black Panthers.
The FBI had, you know, everything to do with the decimation of the Black Panther Party as an organization. The FBI had a counterintelligence program that's called COINTELPRO that basically spied on, intervened in radical organizations. And this was well before the Black Panther Party. It goes back to at least the post-World War II period. And so part of what they did was, you know, surveillance and spying. The FBI often sort of sponsored these agent provocateurs who would go into organizations like the Black Panther Party and create paranoia and, you know, sense of sort of skepticism and distrust among the members of the organization. The effect of the FBI was to both sort of literally attack activist organizations from the outside, but also to corrode them from the inside.
And what happened in the Black Panther Party as a result of this FBI intervention?
Well, I think that people turned against each other. I mean, it's, you know, as someone who interviewed many members of the party for my book, it's still the case that sometimes members of the party will say, well, this happened, or we did this, or we were engaged in this kind of work in the clinic, and then there was this man or this woman who were working there, and we're pretty sure this person was an FBI agent. So there's this sort of still ongoing sense that people, that there were FBI agents. And so there were a lot of, so on a material basis, I mean, the intervention of the FBI and state repression, even on the municipal and local level, meant that places like clinics were, the Black Panther clinics were raided constantly. And so part of why the clinics often had difficulty is that indiscriminately, members of the police department or the FBI would come in and destroy equipment, would tear down walls, would confiscate equipment. Elaine Brown told me a story in Los Angeles in which they were getting a delivery of some equipment from a New Left clinic in another part of town. And then the police followed the truck that was coming to deliver the equipment to them and then confiscated and destroyed it. And it was also the case that the FBI and local state authorities acted on the clinics by sort of tying them up in red tape. So they would try to get them to go to court or have to get licenses and these sorts of things. But the overall effect is that with regard to the Panther activism more generally and health activism in particular is that, you know, we don't have a sense of all of the work that the Panthers were doing. And so part of, you know, people often ask me, why don't we know about the health activism? And part of the reason we don't know is that the FBI's counterintelligence program was so effective in shaping our narrative about the party, not only on people on the right who are critical of the party, but even amongst people on the left who are supportive of the party, such that we have a very, very narrow and very thin sort of narrative of what the party did.
What was the threat that was perceived by the FBI?
Well, I think that the threat was that the party would, in doing these great social welfare programs, would increasingly garner support from local communities and that the movement would grow. And notoriously, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, described the Black Panther Party's breakfast programs, one of its social programs, you know, like the health clinics, as being one of the greatest threats to an American national security. And so there was a sense that the Black Panther Party's social welfare programs, equal to or more so than them carrying bandoliers or carrying guns or defending their communities against police brutality, was the thing that the state was concerned about.
So that comes down to self-determination and self-defense.
Absolutely, yes.
What more needs to be done to alleviate discrimination?
Well, I think part of what needs to be done is that you know, that we need to remember the stories of the Panthers and other people, other activists working during this health activism. So to the extent that the counterintelligence program COINTELPRO is successful in squashing or muting these stories about people's empowerment around healthcare issues and their agency, we need to restore that historical narrative and let people know these stories once again. I think it's, you know, also the case that we need better training for doctors still. I mean, there are, over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there's been an outgrowth of what are called cultural competency programs. So this part of the training for physicians and nurses, which is about getting people to, you know, doctors in particular who often come from elite backgrounds. Regardless of doctors' racial and ethnic backgrounds, they often come from elite backgrounds. And so, you know, there's been efforts through these cultural competency programs to get doctors to have more empathy and to really understand what it must be like to, for example, not have health insurance and to have to rely on emergency rooms, or to have health insurance but to not be treated well, or not to have insurance that's sufficient for the needs that you or one of your loved ones are suffering, and these sorts of things. So I think there are still things that can happen within the healthcare sector. And, you know, frankly and honestly, I think that we need a universal healthcare program so all people have access to healthcare.
What happened to the Black Panthers clinics?
Most of the clinics went away over time. I mean, some of them, a few of them barely got off the ground, and some were more successful. There are no currently existing Black Panther clinics, but there are clinics with deep, deep ties to the Panther legacy that give us an example of how this work has continued. One example is the Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center in Seattle, which is named for a former member of the Black Panther Party who started the Black Panther Health People's Free Medical Clinic in Seattle, in the Seattle chapter in 1968. And Carolyn Downs would die of cervical cancer in 1970. And this is the Carolyn Downs Clinic in Seattle today is a sliding scale nonprofit. And they explicitly are named for this former member of the Black Panther Party. And if you go in the clinic today, which I did as part of my research, you'll see there's a picture of Carolyn Downs, and they pay tribute to her also with a plaque that basically describes the Black Panthers' work in Seattle in this very same neighborhood doing healthcare. And the clinic leadership declares that they're working in the footprints, you know, following in the footprints of the Black Panther Party. It's also the case that many of the people that I interviewed who had worked in Panther clinics are still involved in health work in various forms in their local communities. So, you know, one woman I interviewed who was a member of the New York Panthers working uptown in Manhattan and Harlem and also in the Bronx now works in a community development health and health outreach for a large hospital in New York City. And people went on to get trained as doctors and nurses and these sorts of things.
Well, Professor Alondra Nelson, tell us a little bit about yourself, your childhood. What occurred in your experience that fomented the development of these ideas in you?
Yes, you know, I grew up in San Diego, California. I was the grandchild, I guess, of migrants from the Great Migration. So my father is from New Orleans, Louisiana, and his parents moved from New Orleans to Los Angeles in around World War II. And on my mother's side, my mother's father was an immigrant from Jamaica, and my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was a migrant from Georgia who came to Washington, D.C., as I mentioned earlier. The migrant part of the Black Panther story, I think, very much resonates with me in this sort of sense that I think the children and grandchildren of migrants and immigrants have of, you know, wanting life to be better, or working hard for life to make things easier for your parents and also to have life better for yourself. And so I think that part, that piece of the Black Panther story resonates with me, although I've never been an activist. I think that the migrant part is part of what attracts me to the story for sure.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask a couple of questions. One would be a eureka or an aha moment in your life that you follow that was a shift in your life.
It was the end of a significant romantic relationship, and the gift of that, you know, what at the time was quite sad, a moment in my life was the realization that I think that life is really about change. You know, I think that we get that and we know that and we say that, but the sort of deep realization that part of the beauty of life is about its dynamism and its change, and it's and that the fact that this dynamism and change offers for us, you know, new beginnings, constant surprises, ways to be stronger, new ways of seeing the world.
And tell us, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
It is one precious life, isn't it, Barry? It's so true. You know, what I want to do with the remainder of my life is love those that I love as best as I can and serve those that I love as best as I can. And also, to be of service to the world in the way, in any way that I can. And as a scholar, for me, that's to, you know, write stories that haven't been written and to hope that these stories can be of service to others.
Are there stories currently in the works that you could share with us, you could tell us about?
I'm working on a book called Reconciliation Projects, which is about the use of genetic ancestry tracing. I work in sort of the sociology of race and ethnicity and what might be called African American studies, and I also work in another area, which is the sociology of science and medicine. And so in this project, I'm interested in the phenomenon of genetic ancestry testing, particularly about amongst African Americans and how these tests are being used to sort of reconcile in the sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission way aspects of American history, particularly the after effects of slavery in the U.S.
And finally, Alondra Nelson, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. There's so many books I'd recommend to your listeners. But one of the things I wanted to say about in response to your question about the one precious life was also just to experience beauty and to read beauty and take beauty in and just take time to experience all the beauty in the world. And with that in mind, the book that I want to recommend to your readers is Crave Radiance, New and Selected Poems by Elizabeth Alexander, which is filled with nuggets of beauty and wisdom. It's just an awe-inspiring book.
Professor Alondra Nelson, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry. It was great to be with you.